I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Mike Lynch. Darren Garrett.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jason Gordo.
Here.
Joan Clendenin. We have a quorum.
Okay. Any announcements?
I have several.
Okay.
Anybody else have any?
I have one.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. On September 13th, I attended the attorneys roundtable in San Jose. There were attorneys from every system present. Several systems sent several attorneys, such as LA and Orange County. And it was a very interesting session. The topic, or the main topic that was discussed, was basically the attorney's role in representing the board and the conflicts that could arise between that representation. So it was a very good session, very worthwhile.
Thank you.
I have several announcements. First of all, regarding the DMS White Oak relationship, we had Scott Smith, our attorney representative from Hanson Bridget, take a very close look at it. They asked DMS Offshore and White Oak for agreement, the documents that pertain to the agreement. And essentially, there is no agreement. Scott didn't feel that there was any type of agreement that stated what the fees would be, anything that laid out what the responsibilities of DMS would be to White Oak and to the fiduciaries of the trust. And he didn't feel that it was an enforceable document. So he suggested that we do not return the consent form, but we still would retain our right to have a seat on the advisory committee as laid out in the side letter agreement that we signed with them. So that's the status, and that pretty much closes that issue. Just a couple notes about capital calls over this last week and over the next week. We expect to make about $10 million in capital calls to both Raven and to White Oak, and that would take our total up to about $55 million since we started the direct lending program.
For Jason's sake, why don't you just outline what those deals are?
Yes, I will. I can't give you a lot of detail. I can give you a very high level. One of them with White Oak was two airplanes that we bought and leased back to an Italian carrier. The other one was a group of medical receivables that we purchased. This was through Raven. And then the third, I believe, was some auto leases and receivables, and that also was through Raven.
That's relatively new to this organization is private equity lending.
Correct.
So we've committed money to it, but we haven't had to place it because they haven't had a home for the money.
So the premise was that banks were out there not making traditional loans that they have been, and so this filled the void. We stepped in and filled the void where the banks were lacking. The other issue regarding Dodge and Cox, we had discussed 2 weeks ago that we were going to take them off review. However, come to find out, they never have been on review. They never were put on review. I looked back for the last 2.5 years, and they never were. They've always been in good standing over the last 2.5 years, so consequently, they remain in good standing today. And then finally, I wanted to let you know that Bob Blum, I don't know if you know who Bob Blum is, he is our representative from Hanson and Bridget regarding tax matters. He has actually taken another job, so he won't be representing us anymore, in particular on the voluntary correction program that we're actually going through right now. I will give you an update on that probably in the next month or two, but that program should be winding down. I don't want to get into it now because it'll take a little bit of time. But there are two other principals of the firm that are going to be stepping up and taking Bob's place, and they've assured us that they're going to continue to serve in our best interests as Bob has in the past. That's all.
Okay, moving on to item 4, public comment. I'm going to skip the public comment advisement, so I don't see anybody here from the public. So moving on now to item 5, the consent items. You'll notice the consent items include 5B, which are the service retirements. They were on today's calendar because of the dates, the specific dates for each one. Normally, that's on our first meeting of every month, which is our administrative meeting. You'll see the service retirements listed, but they're on this month because staff needed to correct the dates associated with each one. So that's the only change to the consent calendar for today's meeting. Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar?
I move to approve.
We have a motion to approve. Second. We have a second. So a first by Maria, second by Mike O'Neill. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Moving on now to item six. Semi-annual performance report by Delaware Investments, large cap growth.
We have Kevin Brown, a familiar face from Delaware Investments, who has been our active large cap growth manager for U.S. equity since August 2006, so we're past 7 years, and has added nice alpha since inception of the program.
Great. Hi, everybody. Thanks again for having me. Maybe just as a reminder or for newer folks, I can do the one-minute version to remind you who we are. As Paul said, we manage your large-cap growth equity portfolio. The investment team that runs this portfolio is based in San Francisco, 9 people on the investment team. The one change I should mention is not on the investment team, nor do we expect any change in the investment team, but many of you have been to our offices and met our team. We had 2 traders, Lisa Hansen and Deb Sabo. Lisa's still in this book, in your book. She retired in the middle of July. That personnel page is dated as the end of June. And so Lisa had been a trader for 32 years, all of them on the West Coast, which meant she got up very early in the morning for 32 years. She was with us for 16 years, middle of July, effective resignation date, and went off and got some sleep. So bittersweet for us because she'd been with us for 16 years. Deb Sabo, who many of you met when you visited, has been on our desk for 8 years. So very seamless transition to have her be the head trader. At some point, we'll add a second trader. As you know, we're a low turnover approach, and so we don't often have a lot of trading activity happening in any particular day, but still think it's prudent to have 2 traders on the desk. You also know that we have very, very little personnel turnover, so we'll take probably a painful amount of time to find the right kind of second trader, so that should be coming in the next few months. That's the only change worth mentioning from a team point of view. Our assets are up to about $23 billion in San Francisco across 5 strategies. Again, you're just the one large cap growth strategy, and that strategy is now up to about $15.5 billion in assets. It's always been the biggest thing, biggest product that we have, the one with the longest track record. We have compliant data that goes back to 1994, and it's frankly the one we're most known for in the marketplace. Just to remind you quickly, the philosophy and the way that we manage money is 3 main things. One is we run concentrated portfolios. It's typically 25 to 30 stocks in a portfolio. We try to pay attention to the weight of those stocks. So in other words, there's both a risk and a reward to every company we own. And there's a difference between having a company at the top of the portfolio at a 5 or 6% weight and one that's at the bottom at, say, a 1.5%, 2% weight. So it's not an equal-weighted 25 to 30 stock portfolio where we just put 30 names in a box and hope that you get a couple home runs. There's attention paid to each of those risk rewards in all the different stocks and how they ought to fit into the overall risk reward of the portfolio. So concentration. Second thing is a long-term horizon. I mentioned earlier we're a low turnover approach. It's about a 30% turnover of the portfolio every year, and that includes both major position buys and sells and then trading around positions. So just think about it as roughly 5 to 6, maybe 7 stocks that we'll buy and sell in any particular year. There's no target per se of what we aim for, but it's roughly swapping out 5, 6 names a year. And then the last thing in the philosophy, and then I'll get off that and move to more specifics, is just our take on growth. We are growth investors, and some of our stocks, maybe most of our stocks, will look similar to stocks you'd see in other growth portfolios. But our particular take on growth is the definition of growth. We don't get tied up or held to a definition of growth that's based on revenue growth of a company or reported earnings of a company. For us, it's the growth of the actual cash flow of a company. It's a very cash flow-oriented approach to investing. It's something that value investors tend to pay a little bit more attention to in terms of value of assets and cash flows. But That's our particular valuation paradigm. It's not new. It's something that's been a part of this strategy for decades. And so it's looking at a company's cash flow, the growth of those cash flows, how much of those cash flows can we get our hands on as minority equity position holders. And so that's our particular take, if you will, or bent, or paradigm, if you will, on growth investing. So that lends us to companies sometimes that have huge revenue growth, but as long as they've got the cash flow growth underneath it, great. It also lends us to companies that may not be high-flying revenue growers, but we think there's something interesting going on under the hood. Maybe it's a margin improvement story. Maybe there's a business shift going on that's allowing cash flows to grow, even if revenues aren't growing maybe as fast. And so that lends us to own some stocks that aren't so obviously growth. That's more than a minute. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Happy to shift now to the portfolio and specifics. And in your book, there's lots of slides in there, as always. That's just to be exhaustive. But a couple maybe worth going to right off the bat is in that second section, which is where we have the specifics of the account and the portfolio. And we, as always, put a couple different performance periods in there. There's something that shows you kind of the last, well, the top of those pages on 2.2 and 2.3. The top gives you some time periods in terms of our performance relative to the indices, and then it gives you some top and bottom five contributors and detractors on a relative basis, and happy to talk about any of those. I guess I would say, and by the way, on that first 2.2 is showing you some stock information for the most recent quarter, and then the next page shows you a year-to-date, just to give you a little bit longer time horizon. I guess I would say, just as an opening thought on the performance part of it, a couple takeaways. One is, as stock pickers and as stock selectors and business model identifiers, however you want to characterize our approach, for us to be even close to the benchmark, frankly, on a year that's up 20-something percent year-to-date is somewhat encouraging to us. Those kinds of markets that are up 20-plus percent in a nine-month period might suggest that the investors are just buying anything. They're just buying the stock market and they're going up. And that can be good for diversified many stocks in a portfolio type approach. Not quite as good for stock selectors that are hoping that their stock differentiation that investors are willing to pay for something more specific to company fundamentals. So I would say that we're generally encouraged. We're actually a little bit ahead through yesterday. We're probably, 75 basis points or so ahead of the benchmark year to date. And that's encouraging in a market that's so strong for a specific stock selection strategies like ours. Our long-term performance, don't get me wrong, is much better than that. Our long-term annualized excess return is 400 basis points. So it's not that we're super thrilled to be just 75 basis points ahead. But in a market that's so strong and broad-based, we're pleased to be hanging, and in this case, beating the market a bit. And then the second takeaway, I would say, especially kind of year-to-date or the last year or so, is that the majority of our portfolio is we're sleeping at night. There's not a lot of controversy in the portfolio. There's a couple companies that have some controversy, as is the case almost always in a 25 to 30 stock portfolio. You're going to have a couple troubled children somewhere. There's just been a few of those this year. Happy to talk about them. A couple of them are Verifone and Allergan, a couple companies. Even that's more encouraging recently because Verifone has really come off the bottom and is starting to perform better, and some of those fundamentals are coming back into line. And so we're getting rewarded a bit, if you will. We're getting paid now for having three or four quarters of patience, which isn't always fun and comfortable, but we were willing to live through some controversy and pain to start to get paid, and it feels like we're getting paid a little bit on Verifone finally. It's one of our better stocks in this particular current quarter. So not a lot of controversy, which is nice. And I think maybe I should just stop and take a breath and ask if you want me to go in a different direction, Paul, if there are any questions.
You sold your position in Caterpillar, apparently.
We did. Yeah, we sold a couple stocks in the last couple quarters. We've bought maybe three or four, and we sold a couple. Caterpillar was one of them. Caterpillar, if you remember, we bought a few years ago. It's a little unusual because it is not our typical company. That company tends to be a little more cyclical than we're used to owning. It's more capital intensive. It tends to have its fortunes tied more to the magnitude and the swings of economic cycles. We did it because we thought there was something company specific happening there that could be interesting, that was going to be a little bit different than just the cycle play. They had new management that we thought was going to bring more of this cash flow focus that I talked about earlier to the company. And they had bought a mining company. That acquisition we thought would be more company specific to create more fundamental company change as opposed to cycles. It was those two things were okay. We never got the conviction to move that company higher in the portfolio. It was always kind of a starter two and a quarter percent position. It was unusual in that we only owned it for a couple of years and it didn't really disappoint in any main way, but we couldn't justify taking it higher, and we just felt like we wanted the shelf space for something else. We got a little bit impatient with it, realized it really wasn't enough company-specific change to make a difference, that the cycle stuff was probably going to overwhelm anything there. As you know, we tend not to make calls on cycles or try to pick inflection points, or don't consider ourselves these, you know, fantastic macro thinkers. In fact, we kind of take the opposite approach. We assume we won't get those right. We assume we're not going to get the inflection points right. We may have opinions. We may have on the margin some general outlook ideas, but the approach is actually the opposite, which is own companies you think can perform in a variety of those environments. And again, because CAT was a little bit different from the beginning and it wasn't enough company-specific change happening, we decided to get out.
Do you have a cap on any stock you can't exceed X percent of the portfolio?
Yeah, it's typically 8% of the portfolio that we will not do. We violated it a couple times in the last few years with Apple. The market weight of Apple had grown. We weren't necessarily adding it once it got above 8, but we had started to trim Apple. In retrospect, not enough, but we had started to trim Apple in the 7s and 8s mm-hmm. and 9s as it was really ripping last year, and we trimmed a little bit to kind of get it back down near 8, and then the market took care of some of that by taking it below 8. Apple's kind of a middle of the portfolio position for us now, but 8% is kind of that max single position size.
Kevin, what's your outlook on the financial sector in the near term?
Yeah, we're still not, I would say the qualifier up front is that I'm not so sure we even have a clear-cut outlook on the financial sector per se. I will tell you that we still don't want to own the traditional financials, meaning banks, you know, investment banks, insurance companies. We have an auto insurer company there, Progressive, which has a little bit of interest rate spread risk, if you will. But we're still not believers in the financial sector, that we've gotten to a point, even since the crisis 5 or 6 years later, that the market has really gotten cleared of what the fundamentals are in the financials. There's way too many non-fundamental factors that are involved in, you know, central bank action, fiscal policy, too big to fail, regulation. There's all these things that are meaningful, particularly in that sector, that aren't necessarily fundamental. They're factors for sure, but they're not necessarily company specific or even industry fundamental. So we would have told you 5 or 6 years ago in the middle of the crisis, boy, this could really be an opportunity. The market's going to clear. In other words, you're going to have, you know, banks go out of business. You're going to have bankruptcies. You're going to have lots of M&A where banks are going to buy each other. And then the government stepped in. I'm not making a judgment here. I'm just saying the fact is that there was so much intervention involved that fundamentals kind of got taken out of that industry. So the outlook is to still not go back into that part of the industry and therefore to do what we've done for the last several years, which is to own financials that technically may be called financials as the way that the index providers say, but we'll own transaction-based financials. So we own some of the exchanges. We own Visa, MasterCard, which, by the way, we don't think should even be called financials, but they are, at least according to Russell, called financials. But those are all transaction-based business service-like financials, and that's where we're going to stay for now. We're still not really – there are times when an interesting bank, investment bank, insurance company will come along, and we may take a look at it, but there's just not enough true kind of fundamental factors that are, you know, getting through to all those stocks, and we're going to stay away for now, at least on the traditional stuff.
You mentioned earlier that you were 400 basis points ahead of the benchmark.
Yeah, our long. What I was saying is that
I'm trying to figure out. I'm new.
Yeah.
I've been here 10 minutes.
Fair enough. No worries. I should have been more clear with the context. Our in this strategy's composite, which goes back to 1997, was the inception period of the strategy. Our average annual return over that period is, you know, 400 and something basis points. In any given period, that may not be the case. And the inception of your product is what you see there. Inception of your relationship that started back, what was it, in 2006? Correct. Mm-hmm. It's on August.
I'm assuming these are net of fees.
Yeah, it gives you both gross and net.
The gray bars, net of fees. So
right.
If I'm reading this right, the Russell 1000, 735 basis points versus a net 738 basis points since inception.
That's right, since your account.
So you're
inception.
On par bogey with the index.
That's right, it's in that time period. A little bit ahead in the 5-year, a little bit ahead in the 3-year. And the point I was making is since the inception period of the strategy that goes back into the 1997, the performance is 400 plus on average. And so to be ahead a little bit, whether it's currently ahead by 75 basis points or in your inception period or in the last 3 to 5 years, is not the kind of thing that would get us jumping for joy. We've put up much better performance over different periods, and it will take more than just 75 basis points to be ahead. That was the point I was trying to make.
And this is a domestic strategy, not global?
It's mostly domestic. We have the ability to own up to 15-20%. Honestly, don't remember your specific guideline, but most of the guidelines we have are roughly 15%, could be non-U.S. Typically have been just a couple of companies, somewhere between 4-8% non-U.S. So it's mostly domestic, mostly a U.S. portfolio. That's right. It's because these are large cap companies, the percentage of revenues that come from those companies are big. The percentage of revenues of these companies that come from outside the U.S. tend to be, you know, 40-45%, very similar to what you'd see in, say, the S&P. But in terms of where they're domiciled, yeah, almost all U.S.
Rick, has he seen this value added?
Yes,
I have. Okay. I have.
It
seen
looks
it.
Like we lost $2.5 million of value added in the second quarter.
Correct.
Yeah, and just so I'm clear, this is the absolute
number.
So it's not a relative measure; it's just an absolute.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there's some definition in the chart above it.
Yeah.
To break it out, but how do you explain that?
Well, I'm
looking at the stocks that haven't been, you know, your bottom five producers, you don't have any more than 3-4%, and those are down, what, less than 1% in each of them. But this is about 2.5%.
Yeah, those numbers you're looking at in our book are the relative pain or gain in our portfolio. What has helped or hurt in our portfolio? Mm-hmm. So it's not what the stocks did. The stocks weren't up or down 1 or 2%.
It was the contribution of the
portfolio. Return. Exactly.
Okay, so this is 2%, right?
This is
$2.5 million, $120 million.
This is relative to the benchmark. This is the excess return less fees.
Which makes you
so you underperformed the benchmark in the second quarter, 2013.
Do you? I just don't happen to have the second
Here.
Quarter. No, I have that.
Okay.
So what
I'm
is?
Curious. It means that we must have had more losers in the group of funds than winners?
Yeah.
Here it is.
You can see in the quarter performance right here above the, as you're looking at right there, the second quarter performance, we underperformed relative to the benchmark. So the very left column,
2.2.
We were up just slightly versus an index that was up 2%.
So Jeff, let me explain a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So theoretically, if you look at that number, that excess return for this last quarter, had we invested in a passive benchmark, we would have had $2.4 million or more than had we invested with Delaware. And then you subtract out the fees on top of that, and you get that number on the bottom right. So it's just a relative measure to the benchmark.
It's 1/4.
It was a lot of red, so
well,
I thought about talking about it.
Maybe red's not a good.
No, I think if it goes below the line, it's a really good color.
Yeah, maybe it should be red if it drops below.
Yeah,
the line because they've been
going up
fairly consistent outperformers
right.
over the long
right.
run.
Right. Yeah. To be clear, how do I say this? A 25-30 stock portfolio, and a tracking error, meaning how much are we going to be different than the benchmark up and down? if you run a 25 to 30 stock portfolio, you are almost by definition begging to be different than the benchmark, right? You're basically saying we're making huge bets. Whatever we own, we're going to be well above whatever the index ownership is of that stock, and whatever we don't own, we're going to be effectively short those stocks. We're making a bet not to own the other 700 stocks in the index. So by definition, we're going to be this way. We're going to be above and below the benchmark in any given period. Fortunately, as this side I think is showing, is that over time, we tend to do this pretty well. We may have volatility quarter to quarter, sometimes even year to year. But over time, with a 3 to 5 year time horizon, we get paid for having this approach, this investment philosophy, and that's why you get this cumulative effect of adding value, if you will. So yeah, I don't know if this is your question, but there are times, whether it's a quarter or a several quarters, where we are willing to underperform. It's not that we seek it, but in a 25 to 30 stock portfolio where you have a 3 to 5 year time horizon, you have to be willing to live through some controversy. If you're not willing to do that, you either have to own a lot more stocks, you have to own 60, 70, 80, 100 stocks, which is the average of maybe our peer group or of the market, and keep your tracking error lower and kind of, you know, bunch yourself around the index, or you've got to turn over the portfolio a lot more. When you hit controversy in a stock, you have to say, well, we're not going to wait around for 3 or 4 quarters while Verifone tries to get their act together, and you sell it. That might be fine as long as you sold it and bought something that's going to generate, you know, alpha. And so our approach over time is to be willing to take this kind of pain on short-term time periods, stick with a 3 to 5 year time horizon, and get that kind of result over time. That's the general.
So my question mainly was, this doesn't happen very often, that it goes below the line like that.
Yeah, once in a while.
Yeah, once in a while.
Once
sure.
in a while, but more times it goes up. I was
sure.
just asking if there's an explanation for it.
Yeah, it's really a couple of stocks that were meaningful.
Okay.
So when you look at, that's a good question. I'm sorry I didn't pick it up earlier. When you look at any particular period, whether it's that second quarter or a year, if you just look at our top five contributors and bottom five detractors, that tells you a lot. The middle 20 stocks roughly tend to be noise, kind of cancel each other out. Did you get your top ones right and your bottom ones not so badly? You know, what's that spread? In this June quarter specifically, that's where both two stocks really were pretty meaningful. I honestly don't know the math to know whether those two stocks made up that entire 200 basis points or entire 2 million, but I wouldn't be surprised if those two were the majority of them. Those two stocks, Verifone and Allergan, which were both really weak in that June quarter. So yeah, that's probably what happened. That's probably what got those down. And as I was saying earlier, I don't know what this line is going to look like. Well, I know it's going to be a positive line for this current September quarter that we're in. And one of the stocks that was at least the majority of that down quarter is going to end up being the majority of the positive quarter in this September quarter. So yeah, that's just what we're willing to do. It's interesting, if you just look back at the one that's the most recent painful mm-hmm. one back in December of 2010, that was Visa and MasterCard. Some of you that have really good memories might remember that. Yeah, Visa and MasterCard are big bets for us in the portfolio. And in the middle of December 2010 was when the Fed came out and gave their first guidance on what the price guidance was going to be and how much can you charge for debit card transactions. They came out with that news. Visa and MasterCard were down big in the middle of December. They were down 15 and 20% respectively in a day for those big, you know, well-followed, usually loved companies. And that was something we had to live through in that December period. We added a little bit more, and frankly, those two stocks have been some of our best stocks in the last couple of years. But we are willing, not and happy about it, but we are willing to go through that kind of pain if we think we've got the right 3 to 5 year call. And fortunately, over time, we have gotten paid for living through that stuff and being willing to live through it and not panicking and trying to change the portfolio when you're going through the pain of those quarters. That's key for us.
One real quick question. Internally, yep. So you're using the Russell 1000 Growth Index as a benchmark, and we know there's no fees to a benchmark, right? So you come out of the gate, you're handicapped,
yep.
because we have to pay you.
Yeah.
Because you don't come from San Francisco for free.
Right.
And we understand that.
Right.
Is the Russell 1000 a good benchmark to measure you against, or is there internally a different benchmark that you use when you're in your own boardroom?
Yep.
Sitting around the table. Who's your peer group?
So a couple things. One is that we really don't use the benchmark when we manage the portfolio. We're totally benchmark agnostic. And by that I mean we don't look at, again, it's a 25 to 30 stock portfolio and there's lots of stocks in the index. So we just know if you're going to just own 25 to 30 stocks, you're going to look very different than the benchmark. It's almost impossible to match up in sectors. It's definitely impossible to match up in stock weights, right? Because if you own, I don't know what the weight is of Visa, but if the weight is, if we're at 4% Visa's probably not anything close, maybe 1.5%, 2%. I honestly don't know. That tells you right there that we don't pay a lot of, but the point is we're way overweight Visa, right, relative to the index weight of Visa. We don't pay any attention to what the index weights are. It's a much more absolute value approach or absolute performance approach. So we recognize that if you do the analytics of our 25 to 30 stock portfolio, it'll spit out, your Pulse firm will take it and they'll put it through their analytics and it'll come up with a characterization of what that portfolio is. And based on market cap and the growth profiles of the companies, it'll spit out large cap growth. And so we get put into a bucket of large cap growth, and most of your large cap growth investors are benchmarked to the Russell 1000 growth, and not at all the way we look at how we manage portfolio. We don't pay attention to the sector weights. We don't pay attention to the stock weights in the index. We just run a 25 to 30 stock portfolio, low turnover, try to find the right ones, own them in size, own them through some controversy. And it just so happens the residual effect of that is we put out the numbers we do and it gets measured versus the Russell 1000 growth. We have a handful of accounts that measure us against the S&P 500. We have a handful of accounts that don't put benchmarks on the different asset allocation buckets. They just say, look, for all of our equities, we're going to measure against the MSCI World or whatever it is. And so it really does not matter to us because we don't manage the portfolio with the index in mind.
Pardon me. I thought earlier you started to talk about your tracking rate.
Yeah.
And then you didn't say what it was. And I wondered, well, if you look at your tracking rate, you must be looking at it against something.
Yeah, the tracking, fair question. The tracking error is like our performance. It's just a residual number. We don't manage to get to a tracking error. It's about 500 base points, about 5%.
So against
the Russell 1000 growth. Against the S&P, I don't even know what the guess would be.
But four, it's 5% against the Russell.
So
internally, you must look at the Russell then.
Well, we look at it when we're looking at performance, and because we know that you are, there is a commercial reality to whether you're getting hired, fired, and things like that. But it does not go into the way that we manage portfolio. We don't manage to any particular performance target. We don't manage to any particular tracking error target. The residual effect of all those things has generated some statistics. You know, 5% tracking error. 400 basis points, excess return, those types of things. Yeah.
Trying to understand what you know.
Fair enough, because I've been quoting them, and then I turn around and say it doesn't matter. It's not the way that we manage the portfolio, but we also recognize that it's a language that everyone here at the table has to speak, and we recognize it has a lot to do with the way people feel about our performance. And frankly, we do too. We understand that there's a reality to that. But it doesn't. Our conversation doesn't change at all if you were to say, well, let's look at it versus the S&P 500. Or the MSCI World, or any index you want to, it just wouldn't change the way that we manage the portfolio and the way we feel about it.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? All right.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Moving on now to item 7, 7A, monthly performance review for the month ending of August 31st, 2013 by SIS. Paul?
We go through the monthly performance report for the month of August, starting with the equity indices performance for the U.S., the Russell 3000. We had a down month, down 2.8% for the month. It was a month where growth outperformed value, and small caps decidedly underperformed large caps. Non-U.S. equities performed better than the U.S. That was a change than what we've been seeing lately, with the ACWI ex-U.S. index down 1.36%. Bonds were down again for the month, down 0.51%. This is a area that needs to be paid attention to. You can see year-to-date, the aggregate down 2.8% and the one-year number down 2.5%. We still have 30% plus of our portfolio in fixed income, and that's why we're having a couple education sessions today to address the performance of the aggregate bond index when interest rates rise. Longer term, the Russell 3000 up 20% for 1 year and up 7.6 for 10 years. And non-U.S. longer term has actually performed better than the U.S. 10-year ACWI ex-U.S. up 8.8%. And emerging markets equities, which have been quite weak of late on a relative basis, up 12.5% for the 10-year. Moving on to the next page, the value of the portfolio stood at $1.566 billion at the end of August. You can see our domestic equities at 46%, bonds at 32.5%, direct lending at 2%. As Rick stated, we've had about $20 million in capital calls recently from White Oak and Raven. That will put us around 3.5% target after those capital calls have been made. And we are going to continue kind of a dynamic weighting of the asset classes moving towards our targets adopted last fall. We will make those notations a little more clearer going forward. Page 2, change in assets from the month. We were down $26 million from the end of July. From the prior year, still a healthy plus $146 million. And it should be noted that September has been kind of back to the races again as far as equities are. And we've seen yields come down from their highs a couple weeks ago. Fairly, you know, they were up at 290 on the 10-year, now we're at below 270. So we've seen a decrease in yields from the plateau. Page 3. The market values for each of the managers, and you can see direct lending at 30 will go above 50, as Rick said. And page 4, our cash levels at the manager equity levels, both U.S. and non-U.S., are fairly small at this stage, 11.6 million U.S. equities, just under 3 million international. Page 5, the monthly performance snapshot. We're once again continuing a nice trend of active managers as a group outperforming on a relative basis. That continued from the fiscal year that just ended, June 30th. By the way, I saw some of you had P&I out. The most recent edition of P&I shows the top performing public funds, and Stan Sara came in number 3 in the country at 14.6%, 307 basis points above benchmark.
Did you have any more of your clients in there?
You're the only one, Jeff.
Who was the top one?
Oklahoma Teachers, which is a interesting plan. I'll leave it at that. For the month of August, though, equity managers, we had solid outperformance by Dodge & Cox. Delaware, our two active U.S. large cap managers. Capital Prospects and Legato also perform nicely. And you can see now our fiscal year has 2 months in the books. And although we were down for the month of August, we did outperform on a relative basis in U.S. equities. For fixed income, Dodge and Cox continued to outperform. PIMCO slightly underperformed. And direct lending, we're starting up that program. Raven added a little value in August. White Oak just got started. International equity, both managers were down slightly for the month of August, although LSV for the 2 month is above. And then the REITs were very weak for the U.S. market in August, down 6.8%. Total fund was down 1.44% for the month of August versus the policy index, down minus 172. So we added 28 basis points on fiscal year to date. We're up 32 basis points. And as I said, we should see a decent September if we hold the next four trading sessions. Longer term, page six, the rolling 3-year annualized alphas of the active managers, Dodge and Cox Equity, has shown a swing up. I guess they were not on watch list, but just double secret probation, and now we'll take them off. Page seven, Delaware just came in. They have added nice value these past few years on a rolling 3-year basis. Page eight, capital prospects, quite good. Trending between 2% and 3% of alpha, and Legato now at 1% on a rolling 3-year basis, and they've improved these past 12 to 18 months. LSV, page 10, at 1%, and Pyramus trending right below 2%, and Dodge and Cox fixed income around above 1.5% alpha. I will stop and take any questions on our managers, but overall we've seen a continuation of kind of outperforming in drips month to month, and those drips, as I showed, added up really nicely last fiscal year.
We have 21 million in real estate REITs. I don't know if that's really a good investment for us.
It's something we can look at when we do, I think. Real estate's probably next on the docket as an asset class to look at, so we'll look at that, Jim, and maybe definitely private real estate could be an alternative to that. I think we were thinking going in with the increase in REITs from real estate, from 1.5% to 3.5%, that we would look at private real estate, but we can also look at taking away or taking out the public REIT to a more longer duration dated private real estate investment.
These are traded REITs?
These are, yes, public market REITs, yes.
Is there a manager? Or
it's a passive select index. It's run by BlackRock in a passive.
So it's the BlackRock REIT index?
Yes, it's a passive fund. Our experience is that, and we went through it with another manager, that active managers in public market REITs with their cost structure generally doesn't pay for themselves.
Any further questions on item 7A? If not, move on to item 7B, report on top 10 holdings.
Top 10 holdings for the month of September. I'm going to go quickly over this. Each of the indexes, as you can see, as this was taken September 15th, were up fairly strong manner. Russell 1000 growth up 3.85% on the first page, although the majority of the top 10 holdings are down in relative change in value, which shows the lower caps below the top 10 have been pushing up performance, and it's been a very strong month for small caps once again. Even in the last 2-3 days where the market's corrected a bit, small caps continue to outperform large caps. Page two, the large cap value, BlackRock. Same story, 9 of the 10 top market cap companies in the 1000 value index have underperformed the index itself, once again showing the names below the top 10 have been outperforming. Page three, cap prospects. Good news here, at least as a snapshot of the top 10, 8 of their top 10 holdings have outperformed with very strong performance by their top two names, and the index itself was up 3.8%. Delaware on page four. 6 of their top 10 have outperformed, including the top 4 holdings. As Kevin said, they're having a decent month, month-to-date in September. Page 5, Dodge & Cox Equity. They've had three of their top 10 outperforms with some underperformance in the middle names, Microsoft, Merck, and Hewlett-Packard. Page 6, Legato. Good story here. Number one, the Russell 2000 growth has been the strongest subsector of the U.S. market, up 5% through September 15th. And Legato, seven of their top 10 names have outperformed. Page 7, the S&P 500, similar to the two passive Russell indices, 1,000 growth and value. Good performance, 3.5%, but the top 10 names in market cap, 9 of the 10 have underperformed there, including Apple, number one. Apple, which we talked about a lot with Delaware the last time they were here, they've reduced that to like a 2.5% position in their portfolio, which is actually a fairly substantial underweight to the benchmark. So they actually outperform when Apple underperforms the benchmark at this point. Pages 8 and 9 are their two non-U.S. equity managers. The index has performed quite well at a 6% return as of September 15th. Although for both managers, the majority of their names have underperformed month-to-date through the first half of September. I will take any questions on the top 10.
Okay, any further questions?
Do you have something to report out in terms of our performance?
Paul just touched on the top. We're number three in the nation. But I'll say it again.
You can say it every couple of minutes.
So we'll.
Well, it's a good movement, right? We went from 1% to 14.6 or something like that.
Yeah.
The average of two, we're in good shape.
There you go.
It's so much dependent on the beta of the markets,
yeah.
But that 300 basis points of alpha is, as Rick has alluded to in the past, we can't expect that going forward. Although it's nice to book a year like that, that's for sure.
When you're quoting that 300 basis points of alpha, where are you measuring the
our policy index, the passive weightings of our asset classes. So if U.S. was 40% of our portfolio would be against a 40% weighting in the Russell 3000.
And do we continuously update that on a quarterly or monthly basis?
With the passive index, we review every periodically, and we will change it when we make changes to our asset allocation. But between those periodic reviews, they generally stay static, the policy index. It's not something you want to do too often, but it's something that you do, frankly, more often than we have in the past since the financial crisis, because that's created some additional volatility in the markets where it probably behooves you to do it every couple of years.
Okay. Moving on to item 8.
Okay, item 8 is, I believe, Prima. We have our first education session on fixed income. And as I alluded to in the monthly performance in our fixed income, just the aggregate, what the returns have been, that this has been a focus of us on discussion the last few months. It was one of the first manager structure work we wanted to do was to get the direct lending program started and to look at the fixed income. And out of that came one outcome was two education sessions. One is provided by Prima Capital with Greg White, and he was here a few years ago, actually, presented to some of the board members who were around back then. And we have him back because we have him on at San Joaquin. He offers a investment-grade bond portfolio that would not deviate from our guidelines or policy, and a alternative to a more traditional core or core plus type of fixed income manager measure against the Barclays aggregate.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Greg White. I'm the founder of Prima Capital Advisors. We're a business that
I started approximately 21, 22 years ago. And the materials that you have that have been distributed are going to cover a lot of what I have to say, but I find it always works best if just please fire away, interrupt anytime along the way. So what is our business? We are very simple. We do one thing and only one thing. We make investments in the commercial mortgage space. And we do that three different ways. We make first mortgage loans directly to owners of commercial real estate. We buy investment grade and only investment grade commercial mortgage-backed securities, and come back to that. And the third piece of the puzzle is we buy investment grade only of debt that has been issued by real estate investment trusts, both publicly traded and private companies. There's a couple of things that make us unique in our business. And really the first one is just our total dedication to credit quality. We'd like to consider ourselves just the boring guys who get it right over time. In fact, over the course of roughly 20 years of investing, probably cumulatively about $8 billion worth of investing, we've had one realized loss and one unrealized loss. And that includes the debacle that took place starting around 2008 or so when everybody was whipsawed in many directions. It turned out to be a wonderful time for us. 2009 and 10, as I'll show you, were absolutely terrific years. While everybody was busy doing workouts, we were busy making new investments and making lots of hay for our clients. So how do we get there? What makes us unique? So among other things, we start up with what we call our no list. Now, no list is all the things that we're prohibited from doing. So we cannot make loans or securities that relate to motels, hotels, casinos, nursing homes, raw land, real estate development, significant real estate renovation. In fact, if you have to ask the question, the answer is no. And we put in our specific guidelines, we cannot do those things. It's just amazing if you eliminate those elements of the real estate lending business, how you can do a dramatically better job in terms of lending money, advancing credit. The second thing is that we're real estate experts, if I can use that word, and so we don't take what is commonly known as the actuarial approach to the business. So what most commonly happens when you read about all the bonds that were going down the drain in 2008 and 2009, these were typically pools where someone put together 50, 100, 150 separate loans, and they consolidate them together. We basically don't do that. Our feeling is that we want to deal with a single asset or a small number of assets that we can individually analyze, we can underwrite. So if we make a loan on a property in San Francisco, when we're New York-based, we fly out and we spend a couple of days here looking at it. Same thing if it's the southern part of the country or in our backyard somewhere in New York. It's just amazing how many people don't take that approach. Another thing that we do, we're very fundamental in our approach. Everything's about cash flow, and it's about cash flow that's in place today. So if you ever look at a real estate projection that someone puts together, whether it's for a real estate equity product or a debt product, it does make a difference. There's always this cash flow projection that has a positive slope like this, because somehow rent is always going up 3 to 4% a year, expenses go up 1% a year, and guess what? The profit keeps growing and growing. And it looks wonderful on paper, but it doesn't happen that way in the real world. So we actually go and we do the un-COLA kind of approach. And what we do is we say, what's the cash flow out of particular real estate property that's in place today? And then we say, what can go wrong? Because we're big believers in the whole concept of symmetry. If we're just making a loan, it means if the property appreciates significant value, we don't get any of that value. So why would we want to lend too much? We want to lend less and make sure we're getting it right. Because the most important thing is to get our capital back, plus a suitable rate of return. So we look at cash flow today and we say, how much could the vacancy rate rise in that property? How much could the expenses go up because of rising real estate taxes or rising energy costs or insurance costs? How much could the rental rate actually go down because there's some vacancy in the marketplace and tenants may move? And so if they move, cash flow is going to go down. So our starting point is cash today, and then we unwind the process and we create our own internal version of a stress test and say, can this property withstand it? If you put these pieces together, it takes you a long way towards not making mistakes. Another is if you look at many real estate loans, and again, whether it's a direct loan or whether it's a bond that someone's creating, what they typically do is they say, yeah, the cash flow isn't here, but trust me because. And the because is we have a master lease from somebody, or we have a letter of credit provided as additional support, or someone says, here's some extra cash as collateral, or worse yet, someone says, I'll personally guarantee it. From our standpoint, anytime somebody has to put one of these belts and suspenders in to the package, we don't make the loan. Or we ignore that and say these things don't exist. Because again, when you eliminate all these artificial measures of credit support, when you take them out, you get to the reality of what's actually happening at the property level. So it's the approach we take. Now, I mentioned we do three things. We're making loans, we're buying commercial mortgage-backed securities that are investment grade, and we're making REIT debt. And what we do is we have a very simple approach. It's often referred to in lots of areas of finance as relative value. So what does that mean? It means that if you're typically an insurance company, I don't want to pick on them, somebody in the first or second week in January says, guess what, team? Here's $500 million. Here's $7 billion, or if you like Metropolitan Life, and we expect you to invest it. So what they do is they spend that money. And by hook or by crook, in those next 11 months, they race like crazy to get the dollars out the door. There's a different department. That's the bond department. And they're given a different amount of money to buy CMBS. And then there's the corporate bond department that's buying REIT bonds. And so Department A doesn't speak to Department B, which doesn't speak to Department C. We're all one department. So what happens is, for example, in 2009, when the market had fallen apart and there was most institutions were on the sidelines, we were being called, would we make a loan on what was a very high quality property, and we could get interest rates that would be, say, between 7 and 8%. Well, you'd look and say, not bad. And you'd look at the credit metrics, you'd say, pretty good. Problem was, we wouldn't make those loans. And there was nothing wrong with them. But real estate investment trusts had gotten totally whacked. And their bonds were trading in the secondary market at dollar prices between 50 and 70 cents on the dollar, and their yields were trading between 10 and 13%. So we said, make a good loan, earn 7-8, buy a simple bond, same credit metrics, earn 11-12. We said, we'll buy the bond. We did the same thing with single asset CMBS, where we were buying bonds secured by a regional shopping mall or a high quality midtown Manhattan office building, and we were getting returns that were in the 13 to 15%. Fast forward now a couple years, we had built up a portfolio. As much as 25% of our portfolio was in REIT bonds. Today, it's down to about 1%. Those REIT bonds that we had purchased at 50 to 70 cents on the dollar, today are trading between 115 and 120 cents on the dollar. So we like them a lot, not at those prices. We love selling them. So we turn around. So what are we doing today? We're making some loans, and we're making some investments in the CMBS single asset space or small pool space. We've done nothing but sell our REIT bond holdings. So what we really are is we're one factory that looks at all of these and we say, what makes the most sense? And we do more of those or fewer of the others depending on what's going on in the marketplace. In the way of background, and you'll see it on some of the pages here, we today invest approximately $2.5 billion. Something like, I don't know the precise number, 80% of our clients are public pension funds. We started investing in 1995 with the City and County Employees Retirement System of San Francisco, and I'll show you, we share with you here today our results on behalf of that separate account. It started in 1995 as a $75 million allocation, and today in round numbers it's about $500 million. Interestingly, and it's, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, we actually peaked at about $600 million, and the last 2 years they've cut us back by more than $100 million for the simple reason that through the 2008 to 10 time period, we kept growing, and most of the other guys kept shrinking. So we became too large a percentage of their portfolio. They said, you guys are too good, you can't get to be so big, and they actually cut us back. So, you know, it's a sad, but this is the reality of the way the world works. Here in the Bay Area, or Greater Bay Area, we also have, and with Paul, for about 3.5 years now, we've been working with San Joaquin County. They started at $50 million, if I remember correctly, and we're up to about $175 million with them. Also in the state of California, Santa Barbara County. You'll notice it's on page number 6. We list who our clients are, and you can see whether it's the state of Maine or in the Midwest, Kentucky and Indiana, or a little bit further west, Colorado, or further west yet, in New Mexico. There's a fairly large collection of public pension funds. Generally speaking, it's wonderful that when they join us, they tend to grow over time. People tend not to leave because our performance has been very consistent, and I'd like to say very good. We invest vis-a-vis our clients two ways, simplistically. We run a fund. It's called the, not surprisingly, Prima Mortgage Investment Trust, and today it's approximately $800 million in size. And if you look on that page 6, the names listed on the left are the investors in that fund. It's an open-ended fund, and we accept new contributions on a quarterly basis. And if someone wants to get out, and that's only happened once in the last 10 years, we take them out on a quarterly basis as well. Or in the alternative, we create separate accounts. And the separate accounts basically do the exact same thing we do for our fund. The difference is that they can be customized. So we represent New York State teachers. Today we're about $360 million with New York State teachers. We started at 50. In the case of state teachers, they have an internal staff that makes loans, so we can only buy securities for them. We also represent New York Common Retirement Fund. They have a staff that buys bonds, so we just make loans for them. But the fundamental approach to our investing, our style of investing, our philosophy of investing, that doesn't change. So if someone came along, if you said, I want you guys to be the risk takers, you guys are good, just really step it up, we'd say, thanks, but no thanks. That's not for us. We think we know what we do well, and we like to stick with that. In fact, we only would stick with that. A couple other factors, we're unleveraged. We don't borrow any money. Our documents, whether it's in our fund or separate accounts, prohibit us from borrowing money. So the numbers I'll go through with you shortly, all are ones which are totally unleveraged. And we think that, again, if you look at our return, we're very proud of that. If you look at what happened during the 2009-2010 time period, an awful lot of guys had borrowed money. They had margin calls. And what happens when you have a margin call? You have to sell. And when you sell, what do you sell? You always sell your good stuff, because that's the only thing you can sell. You can't sell the bad stuff. And so we sat there kind of like this, feeling pretty good. Remember Trading Places, doing this. All the guys who had to sell, we sit there buying in the things they had to sell, except we bought them at very good prices, like buying in our REIT debt. So we believe in being unleveraged. We think it provides a very solid foundation of really trying to minimize risk. If I may just jump ahead for a second, if you turn to page 11, and then if you can kind of flip back and forth, page 14, these are companion charts, and what they represent is the year-by-year breakdown of our income return, along with our price change and our total return, and how we did versus the Barclays aggregate. And a couple of things I'd point out to you as you look over these pages. And again, the first one, page 11, this is our separate account with City and County of San Francisco. And on page 14 is the identical chart, only it's for our open-ended fund, the Prima Mortgage Investment Trust. So a couple of things. If you look in the left-hand column, second one from the left, you can see our income numbers. They're pretty robust. Our fees are very, very modest. And what we basically do is we distribute on a quarterly basis, unless you want to reinvest, and we have that, so you can change your mind. San Joaquin started investing in, and basically asked us to reinvest the monthly income that we produced. And then about 6-9 months ago, they said, no, we have to pay beneficiaries. We'd love to have your income. And so we checked a box off, and now we distribute the monthly income to them. It doesn't really make a difference to us one way or the other. But today, we're running at, in round numbers, net about a 5.5% current cash return distributable to our clients. And if you look over time, you can see how that number is bounced around across the clients. I'd also call your attention to the valuation column. And in particular, please look at 2008. Because regardless of which table you're looking at, the valuation number in 2008 was an absolutely miserable number. But we mark to market our holdings every single month. And the numbers we report there, which were terribly negative, was nothing more than a mark to reflect the fact that, if you recall, in the fourth quarter of 2008, the capital markets came to a screeching halt, and there was basically no bid for anything. So you could be honest, and you could say if you had to sell something, it would be worth a lot less. Where you could play games and say, nah, it's not really a normal market, and you could keep values constant. We took the form approach and said, this is nonsense. At the moment, if we had to sell, we'd get a lot less, and we wrote things down substantially. But if you look at 2009 and 2010, you see our numbers are quite robust, and 50% of that is because it was a mark-to-market adjustment. We never had bad loans, but we had written things down too much, and so 2009 and 2010 was nothing more than writing things back up. And the other part of it was, very simply, that when everybody was in the sidelines, we were making lots of new investments in that 2009 and 2000 time period, among others when San Joaquin came on board and we were able to produce what we thought were really terrific results. So if you look at the column on the far right, that's our relative performance to the Barclays aggregate, and you'll see that with very few exceptions, we've dramatically outperformed on a fairly consistent basis, including this past year, quite handsomely. We're always asked the question, is the Barclays aggregate the right index? And in the end, I knew you were going to go there, Jason. And the answer is no, it's not. But it was, I think, Churchill who once said, democracy is the worst form of government except for everything else. And we've yet to find what we think is a really good index. There is something that's produced by Barclays, previously Lehman, the Lehman CMBS index. But the original index, which had grown to $700 million because of problems, the market has shrunk to $300-something billion. And it represents all the deals that blew up some years ago. So if we compared that, we'd look amazingly good, and it's not really indicative. It's just a flawed index of the way things have changed. So our feeling is to use the Barclays Ag, as it's probably an index that you're seeing on a fairly regular basis across a large swath of clients and money managers you deal with. And since we only deal in the investment grade space, we think it should give you a pretty good handle on what's going on. We've yet to have someone come and say, here's a better way to go about it, but we're totally open to customizing any index that you would like to have. We just have yet to find one that's really good. So it's flawed, but we say it up front it's flawed, and that's, we just haven't come up with a better alternative. If you flip the page in each one of these, so you go to page 12 and you go to page 15, sometimes people like pictures instead of numbers. I'm a former engineer by training, so I was always taught draw the picture. It's a much easier way to get through things. And so you can see how we look on a 1, 3, and 5-year basis. If you look on page 12 and you look at 2008 was our bad year. So when we, from the preceding page, that's when we wrote things down. So we're going to start to look really, really robust as we go forward. And we're pleased with that, but notwithstanding the fact, I think the real message here is that we've been very consistent in terms of the returns that we've produced, certainly on a relative basis. Two other charts, or one of the charts that I think is maybe most important of everything, if you turn to page 18, so page 18 basically has two lines on it. The blue line, which is running off the page, measures the delinquency statistic for the industry as a whole, for commercial mortgage-backed securities, and you can see for about 4 years now it's been hovering around 10%. And it moves around some, but it's been fairly consistent. Not a very good business if that's what you're doing. And then if you look at the bottom line on the very bottom of the page in red, that's us. So we had a loss in 2009, one, that's it. And so, and we had, if you look carefully, you can see in what would be 2002, there's a little slight kink in the red there, and we had a loss that was there nominal. So it was one realized loss and one unrealized loss, although we wrote it off on our books to be conservative on a mark-to-market basis in 2009. That's it, over basically 20 years. So if there's a takeaway, we invest on a relative value basis in the commercial mortgage market. We're painfully conservative in the approach that we take, and yet because we're conservative but we stick with the right things, and because of the relative value approach, we can produce returns like you just saw, which we think are substantially ahead of most of the guys in the business. In fact, for many of our clients, we outperform their junk bond managers, even though they're non-investment grade and we're investment grade, and often those guys lever their investments and we don't have any leverage. Our books are audited by Pricewaterhouse. In the case of our fund, Cushman & Wakefield, the international national appraisal firm, they do an independent valuation of our portfolio every year, along with doing a monthly review of our monthly mark-to-markets. We have a small staff that's based in New York, so there's four senior professionals. I'm not actually the old guy in the room, but I'm close to being the old guy in the room. And what we basically do is we don't hire young guys who we're trying to teach. We have professionals who've been in the business for 17 to 35 years, and we don't have fancy computer models. It's been my experience that the fancier the computer and the better the run that you can do, the more you can confuse yourself and start to believe the numbers instead of just sticking with the fundamentals. On that respect, with respect to real estate, because at the end of the day, we're taking real estate credit risk, just one more sense of our approach to the business. So before it was popular, we would not make a loan on a shopping center if the major tenants were Circuit City or Best Buy or Barnes & Noble. Well, now Circuit City is gone, so you say, of course. And Best Buy is having a little bit of a resurgence here, but we don't like them. And maybe you invest in them, maybe you don't, I apologize. But if you think about when you walk into a Best Buy or what was Circuit City store, everything they sell basically is obsolete in 6 months. You don't buy last year's computer. You don't buy the 4C phone, you buy the 5C phone or whatever it's going to be. And everything they sell has small profit margins, and everything they sell you can buy on Amazon. So why do we want to be an investor in the real estate and the business that we think is fundamentally not a great business? Who goes to Barnes & Noble these days? People to meet their friends and have a cup of coffee. But you buy your book electronically. So we don't want to be the lender on something where the business itself in longer term doesn't make sense. So we'll invest in retail properties. We have a lot of retail exposure. It's the supermarket. It's the Safeway around the corner. Or Stop and Shop in our part of the country. Or Domino's, or Dominic's, I'm sorry, in the Chicago area, et cetera. The big regional shopping malls, so if you've been to Hawaii, the Ala Moana shopping mall, very happy with that. There's the South Coast Plaza, very not happy. We don't have that one, happy to have that. In office buildings, we get nervous about any town suburban USA. So with all due respect, we're not rushing to make suburban office loans in Modesto. We're just not. But nor are we looking to do them in Houston or Dallas or Las Vegas or Phoenix, because when you look out the window, all you see is parking lots and land to build more properties. So put a city like Atlanta, I mean, it's a wonderful growth city. The problem is the developers know that, and they're always building for growth 5 years from now. In fact, if I showed you a curve, because we track these things, rental rates in Atlanta for the last 20, 25 years in office buildings, it's just like this, flat as a pancake. So if the rents don't really go up, why do we want to be exposing ourselves to that kind of risk? Now, would we? If we had a long-term lease to Coca-Cola, we'd probably consider something like that. But if it's 10 different tenants and their leases are coming due in the next 2-3 years, not going to be so crazy to do that. We make very few loans in the multifamily space. You might say, that's crazy. It's one of the strongest areas in the country the last couple of years. Yes, but who's the dominant maker of loans to multifamily properties? Fannie and Freddie. So if we make a loan, generally, it means that you outcompeted the U.S. government. You loaned at a lower rate, and you loaned more money, because that's how you won the loan. That's a dumb business. The guy who's making the largest loan for the lowest rate, not a good business. So we're not interested in doing that. So we have some multifamily loans, but they tend to be unique situations. They're not the run-of-the-mill properties, because we think you can get hurt in those. We like industrial property. They're difficult to do. They're difficult because everybody's always underweight. And this goes back to what I said earlier about spenders versus investors. Once you have to fulfill an allocation, you start to do the wrong thing. If you have to be 30% industrial, then you're going to get to be 30% industrial, but you may not be doing it the right time in the right way. So if the right industrial deal comes along, and we did one last month, that's good. If it doesn't, we're underweight industrial. We don't care. We want to be in locations where things are dynamic. So yes, I'm a New Yorker, I apologize, but we like Midtown Manhattan. We don't like Lower Manhattan. We like almost anything Washington, D.C., because we know the government always grows. We definitely like San Francisco. We're always nervous about Chicago. We tend to like Boston. And just because we like something doesn't mean it's forever. So if you've been to Boston lately, there's a whole bunch of development right on the wharfs, the east part of the city. It's a real problem. I mean, as a tourist, great to go there, have some fresh seafood, have a beer or something like that. As an office worker, there's only one or two ways in and out. The traffic every single day is a killer. We don't want to invest in a loan, in an office building where the traffic's awful, because eventually you, the tenant, are going to say, I don't want to be here. Let's move. So we're looking at real estate intrinsics first and second. We're looking at property market intrinsics, and we're doing what I mentioned earlier, which is trying to get the cash flow right. And what we find is if you do all those things together, you can have a pretty good batting average. In fact, we like to think ours is really good, although you've heard me say this before. But, I mean, we apologize to our existing clients because we did have a decade ago, 11 years ago, and 4 years ago we had a bad loan. But having said that, still not such a bad track record. Let me call your attention to a couple other charts in here, and then I'm going to shut up because you haven't asked any questions. So I know I kind of covered everything. If you turn towards the back to page 33. So this is a chart, it's titled Rating Actions. And what we're tracking here are the bond ratings that have been assigned by Moody's and Standard & Poor's over the last decade or so, more than the last decade. And if you're good at telling the difference between red and blue, blue means it's an upgrade and red means a downgrade. So if you look for the first 7 or 8 years, everything was only upgraded by the agencies and it was never downgraded. If you look at the last 4 years, everything's downgraded and nothing's ever upgraded. What that tells us, and we work with them all the time, is the rating agencies really don't know what's going on. So we only get by things that have a rating because we're required to buy investment grade rated bonds, but we do not rely on them. Because if we rely on them, you wind up with that performance that shows all those heavy duty delinquencies. We need to do our own underwriting. We want to know what they have to say because it's nice to have somebody else's opinion and a third opinion. We don't want to close ourselves off to the real world. But the reality is if you rely on these guys, it's probably not going to have a happy ending. One other thing which I didn't mention to our strategy, which is critically important. So we buy rated securities, but we also sell rated securities. And one of the reasons why our performance has been so good from an absolute total rate of return basis is because of that phenomena. So let me explain. And I'll hopefully do this both simplistically but completely. Over the course of a year, two or three, we'll take the assets that we purchased on behalf of our clients, which could be some loans, it could be some bonds from CMBS, or it could be some REIT bonds. And when the market is really paying up, the spread is very tight, and people really want to buy AAA bonds, and they really want to buy AA bonds, what we do is we accommodate them. So we take our pool of our assets, we pool them together, we march to Moody's and Standard & Poor's, who rate them. And in fact, on a historical basis, they've said that when we pool these things together, roughly 90% of what we have is investment grade rated, and usually about 80 to 85% is rated AAA and AA. And what we do is we turn around and we sell those AAA and AA bonds to investors in the marketplace who are dying to have these bonds, except they pay a really high price. And so if they sell a really high price, it's just another way of us of saying, well, prices are high, we're going to be sellers. So it's kind of like your kids, which one do you love the best? Well, on any given day, you know he's no who. But overall, right, you know, you love them all the same. And so same thing. We like all our positions until we don't. If the market's going to pay a really high price, see ya, we're happy to sell those positions. And we use this securitization process. Now, when we do that, three things happen. First, we sell at a high price, but we don't sell the whole thing, and we keep a portion. We keep the bottom portion. Because we sold the top portion at a very tight spread or low yield, it means the yield on the piece we keep gets to be very high. And in fact, the yields range from these days 8% to, in the past, as high as 15 to 20%. So if you make new assets today and you turn around and blend them with the retained portions of these pieces we've sold, you wind up with, in the last year or two, we basically come and say, I think we're going to do, on a steady state basis, absent any kind of crazy move in the market, a mid to high single digit total rate of return. So we told our clients this year, before the market started to move, assume somewhere between 7 and 8% as our total return for the year. We've dramatically outperformed it the last 4 years. This year, not so much, because as you know, what happened in the second quarter of this year, rates went up by more than 100 basis points in 3 months. So it hurt us a little bit. So we still have a positive year. We have an okay year. It's, on a relative basis, it's a great year, but you don't eat relativity. You know, your beneficiaries need cash. They don't need relativity. So to us, it still matters what the total rate of return is, and we're still doing our best to work on that basis. So we use these securitizations to boost the return. The other thing that we do, we've been nervous now for 2 years. So for a year and a half, we were wrong. For the last half year, we've been right about general movement rates. We've been thinking they're going to start to climb, and they actually finally have. So we do these securitizations, and we'll take some of our longer-dated bonds or loans that we had, and we put them into the securitization. It's nothing more than selling. So we do that as a way of managing our duration, and these days we're trying to manage our duration to a somewhat shorter time. So if rates were to continue their trek, and my sense is that's going to happen again maybe after the first of the year, that we will not be hurt or be hurt as much when that process happens again. In fact, we're completing what will be our eighth securitization this week, next week. And so if we've been in business for roughly 21 years or so, that works out to be almost every 3 years. We've done the last couple of years, but we did one in 05 and 06, and after 06 we didn't do another one until 2011. Why? Because when the market got out of whack in 2008 and 2009, if we were selling, we'd be selling the high price. We'd be selling the low price and the high yield. We don't want to sell somebody high yield. We want to buy high yield. We want to sell somebody low yield. So when the markets cooperate, we want to be sellers. When the markets don't cooperate, we want to be buyers. One or two more charts here. If you flip the next page, which is page 34, and I'm just about done. Page 34 shows the level of new development, basically new construction for three of the major property types for the last 10, 15 years. And I think the takeaway here is that if you look on the far right, it's been a bunch of years since we've had anything. Yes, you can show me a building in south of Market Street that's going up or being renovated or something in D.C. or New York. But by and large, as a country, we've stopped building a while ago. However, if you go to the next page, the last page here, and this is for the office market, if you look, you can see the red line. The red line is the vacancy rate for office properties all around the country. And it's around 17%, hasn't budged for a while. So remember, pricing is all a function of supply and demand. So we haven't added anything to supply, but the flip side is that supply hasn't budged either because there's not been enough demand. So you tell me when there's going to be a fairly robust pickup in employment across the country, not just some temp workers here and some temp workers there. And then you'll start to see some more office space get absorbed. When that happens, these rates will come down. But until that happens, real estate owners, for the most part, don't have pricing pressure. There's no pricing pressure, no pricing power. So if you look at the blue lines in this chart, that's the rental rate. Again, this is generic because it's across the country as a whole, and there's always an individual market that's an exception. But if you look at this, you can see that rental rates for the last 4 or 5 years have basically been flat. So if you're a real estate owner, it means the only way you're making money is by basically selling at a higher price because the PE ratio is expanded or the cap rate is contracted. You're not making it on real estate fundamentals. So for our business, it's all about getting the fundamentals right. So when we're underwriting our loans, we're not assuming, as I alluded to earlier, there's going to be any kinds of appreciation. Because at the end of the day, what the numbers will show you is, yes, there's an exception here, there's an exception there, but by and large, it's not happening. So when we see something change fundamentally in the country and there's real employment growth, these things will start to change. Probably be a great time to invest in real estate equities. But right now, not so much. There's a reason why the question was about REIT shares. So REIT shares, because the underlying performance, the cash flow of the REITs, has not been spectacular, and individual investors are dividend buyers. As soon as rates start to go up, they become much less interested in that dividend. It suddenly becomes too low because they're not focused on their fundamentals of the real estate, which is one of the things that's driving that. So it just comes back to, again, the beginning. If you focus on the real estate, you're not trying to spend money, you're just trying to be a solid investor with the passage of time, we think you can get this business really right. Please.
You guys have done a great job over time, but I have a couple questions. You spoke briefly about a tightening of duration or a shortening of that duration. What is your current duration? What's the term on that now?
Yep.
And then we've been in such a low interest rate environment over the next 3 to 5. Mm-hmm. What is your belief that will happen? What will happen with rates? And more importantly, what's going to happen to your yield over that same period of time?
Okay. So if you turn to page 16, and this is our fund, our duration at the end of August was 3.93 years. And we wouldn't mind getting that to closer to 3.5 or so. When every quarter we send out a fairly detailed financial report to our clients, and we also accompany that with a 3 or 4 page letter that my colleagues and I write about how our performance was, plus what's going on in the world. And we said in our year-end letter of 2012 and our first quarter letter that if rates were start to rise, that every 100 basis point rise in the 10-year would hurt us to the tune of about a 2-point change in price. We did not think that there'd be a 125 basis point rise in 3 months' time, and yet if you looked at our performance in the second quarter, we were hit, but not even by as much as we thought. That's partially because of the duration management that we've been doing and we're going to continue. One of the things that we've been doing a very small amount of and will increase over time for the right situation, we've been gradually, where possible, increasing our floating rate loans because they have near perfect, in essence, duration protection in terms of what's going on. Some people say, why don't you do floating rates all the time? And we tell them because we think the floating rate business generically is a flawed business model. And let me explain why, because you may not have heard this before. But who borrows? When a real estate owner borrows on a floating rate basis, why do they do it? They do it simply because the asset itself is not yet in a position to be financed on a fixed rate basis for the long term. Not always, but often the case. So that means the asset's called transitional. There's a major lease that's coming due, or there's a major vacancy, or there's lots of renovation work that has to be done. As soon as they tie up that lease, as soon as they finish the renovation, they're going to put long-term financing in place. So those are the guys, you're making floating rate loans to those people. The problem is that at the end of the year, or 6 months, or a year and a half, if the good thing happened, your loan's paid off. If, however, it didn't transition like it's supposed to, that loan sits on your books. So the floating rate lender, over time, winds up with adverse selection. The good ones go away, and the less good ones are the ones that wind up staying on your books. Now, there's exceptions, and those are the ones we look at. So, for instance, we've made 3 floating rate loans in the last year where Blackstone was the buyer. They bought a portfolio of properties. And I'll make up a number because I don't remember percent. Say they bought 25 properties. Their goal is to wind up with 16 or 17 of the properties and shed the others. If they put in place fixed rate financing today, they can't easily shed those assets without incurring prepayment penalties. If, on the other hand, they put in floating rate financing, it'll last for a year or two. They'll sell all the assets they want to get rid of, then they'll pay us off. we don't mind getting paid off, because in the interim here, during this period of time where we're worried about rates, we're happy to have that insulation from it. And to answer more precisely, my own sense is that if you look at how the market has behaved in the last 4 months, where today Citigroup announced firing 1,000 people, Wells Fargo's fired 3,000 or something like that in a single family mortgage. Yeah, I mean, lots and lots of numbers are going on. That was from 100 basis point rise that took place in the market. So my sense is that the Fed has to turn off the machine. They can't keep the printing presses going forever. But I think they're going to be really scared. So I think it's going to be this kind of sawtooth start-stop basis that we're kind of living in now. My crystal ball is no better than anybody else's. That's just my forecast from it. And so we're very mindful of this fear of the rising rates, and we're going to use things like our current securitization to manage a way to minimize the pain and do some things like some floaters where we can to take advantage of that. And we'll get hit a little bit. And the flip side is, as they go up, instead of averaging, we're 5.32 is our current yield. Instead of averaging 5.32, a year from now, if they go up, it'll be 6.32 or 7.32. That doesn't really bother us so much. Particularly if we can walk in here one day, or any of our clients, and say, by the way, the doors are open on Jan 1st, and we have a 7.5% current return. Given the actuarial assumption for most pension funds in the country, we're actually feeling pretty good about that. Did I answer your questions?
You did. Yeah, thank you.
Page 7, can you tell me where your name came about from the wind?
Yes. Let me just look at page 7, and I'll hopefully amuse you a little bit. So the history of the business is very simple. I'm an ex-Wall Streeter. I was at Salomon Brothers for 10 years. I was the co-head of the firm's real estate department, and in 1992, I left and started this business, and I started with a former client of mine, which was affiliated with the Schroeder Group in the UK. In 1998, my partners came to me, and they were the money partners, and they said, we're selling, we're retiring from the business. And I said, well, I'm not selling. This business is just getting started, and we're starting to do pretty well. And along came Conning Asset Management, a publicly traded money management company that was affiliated with General American Life Insurance Company. They said, we'll buy the business and here's the price, but we'll only buy 100%. They wouldn't just buy out my partners and not me. The price was high enough, and I said, oh, okay, I'll do something for my family, and sold and became an employee for Conning. In the next 3 years or 4 years, Conning's parent company had all kinds of financial gyrations. So General American, big, big insurance company in St. Louis, went bankrupt. And they sold General American and everything that it owned, which was Conning, to MetLife. And a year later, MetLife sold Conning to Swiss Re. And a year later was 9/11, and the word from Zurich came out, if it's non-strategic and it's the United States, sell it. And so I bought the business back. And to answer your question, so we had a dinner conference. I first spoke to my lawyers, and I said, we're going to call the business Commercial Mortgage Advisors. And we were all agreed until the lawyers came back and said, if you use the word mortgage in your name in New York State, you need special banking authority approval. It's going to take a year to get. And so we had a dinner conversation, and my little one is now 23, Jessica, and she said, let's call it Jessica Advisors. And so her older brother, Andrew, who's 27, said, oh, no. Of course it should be Andrew Advisors. So we had to split the difference, and there's a ski trail on Vail Mountain that I've never been on because I'm not good enough. It's called Prima. And Prima in Italian means first. So we said, well, first, and the family joke is that I've never been on because I would kill myself. And so that's how the Prima name came about.
Can you turn to the next to last page and
please
talk about fees? You've got 40 basis points, 75, and another 75 to explain.
Yes. So our running fee, by the way, does anybody have this? I don't recall if we distributed this or not.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. I wasn't sure if I messed up. So our running fee is 40 basis points on the mark-to-market value of our portfolio. So value goes down, our fee goes down, portfolio goes up. That's the steady state it gets paid on a monthly basis. When we make new investments, there's a 3/4 point investment fee. If it's a loan, it's almost always paid for by the person we're lending money to. It doesn't cost our clients a nickel. If it's a security, implicitly our clients are paying for that fee. For all intents and purposes, that's it. The exception is when we do these securitizations. And again, we've done it 8 times in, call it, 21 years. We're entitled to a fee that maxes out at 3/4 point, depending on how much profit we create in the transaction. So if we were to do one of these securitizations and it didn't generate a minimum profit, and it's a longer conversation to describe it than right now, we'd get no fee. Naturally, we don't do that because our game, the goal is to make a big profit for you guys. So if the profit's high enough, then we're entitled to a 3/4-point fee of the bonds that we sell in the securitization. So basically, on a running basis, on a regular per annum basis, it's the 40 basis points and some portion of that 75 when we're making investments, because again, when we're making loans, that fee is paid for by the borrowers, not by our client. And the expenses are effectively minimal, because other than paying for Price Waterhouse, and one other thing is we basically eat almost everything. There's no performance fee, there's no anything like that. It's just very simple. What else?
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate your time.
You bet.
Safe flight home. Yeah, appreciate it.
Okay. PIMCO, Fixed Income, a Tactical and Unconstrained Strategy.
We got Mark Romano and Todd Staley from PIMCO, and we invite them to perform an education session looking at our current fixed income portfolio and what ways they rates. Might believe internally they could improve it in a rising rate environment.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. It's great to see board members as well as the staff today. First of all, we want to start by thanking you for your continued trust in PIMCO and allowing us to manage $110 million on behalf of your plan participants. Secondly, thank you for your time today as Mark and I came prepared to talk about the evolution of the fixed income landscape. We divided our presentation really into two parts. The first part will talk about where we've gone with the fixed income landscape and where we're coming from, the decline in interest rates around the world. And the second part, I'll turn it over to Mark, who will discuss potential strategy changes you can make within your fixed income portfolio to position it for the environment ahead. By introduction, Mark doesn't come around the board as much in the last 2 years, but you've met Mark several times prior to that, and most recently Mark was here to discuss expanding investment discretion within your Core Plus portfolio, and notably high yield, and allowing us to tactically allocate to high yield securities. So Mark can provide an update on sure. that as well. Mm-hmm. It's our understanding that we have about 30 minutes today. Is that, Paul, 20, 30 minutes? Okay, great. If I could turn everyone's attention to page 4 in our presentation, I just want to highlight a couple themes of core bonds. And these are themes you're familiar with, but core bonds should really provide, you know, certain characteristics for a multi-asset class plan. One, liquidity, income, as well as serve as equity risk diversifying asset classes. And over the last 30 years, core bonds have served this purpose. And core bonds have generated attractive returns as interest rates around the world have fallen. However, with treasury yields near all-time lows, there is an asymmetric risk profile for fixed income securities. Yes, yields could fall, but yields could also rise on a longer term basis. And we think it's prudent for boards to consider potential tweaks to their core bonds allocation to position it for the coming years. On page 5, you'll see the main risk for a fixed income security, which is, as you're aware of, is interest rate risk. However, I do want to highlight one theme, and that's the first bullet point, which in 1981, a 10-year Treasury security yielded 14%. Today, it yields about 2.75%. And the chart on the right is very telling. The top right is you'll see that the duration of a 10-year Treasury bond has increased from about 7 years to 9 years over the last 20 years. So effectively, investors who are investing in 10-year Treasuries or fixed income securities are getting compensated less for taking more interest rate risk. And the table on the bottom left might be most relevant to this board is the Barclays Aggregate Index, which is the benchmark for the PIMCO Core Plus bond portfolio, is shown on the bottom left. And you'll see that the yield as of 6/30 was about 2.5%, 2.35%. And if you think interest rates don't change or credit spreads don't change over a 12-month period, that could be the expected return for this type of mandate. However, if interest rates just went up slightly, you could actually have a flat return of 0% or even negative. And that's why we're here today, to talk about some of the ways you can diversify your fixed income portfolio. A couple more pages before I hand it off to Mark and just where we are currently. As you'll see on page 6, we highlight the components of the Barclays Aggregate Index. And the Barclays Aggregate Index, as you're probably aware, is a market-weighted index. And what does that mean? The more debt a company or an issuer has outstanding, the larger percent of the index it becomes. So the U.S. government is a great example. In 2008, it was 25% of the Barclays Aggregate Index, U.S. Treasury securities. Today, it's roughly 36%. So as the U.S. government ran structural deficits of, you know, $1 trillion in some years over the last 5 years, they became a bigger percentage of the index. And the chart on the right shows that 76% of the Barclays Aggregate Index is U.S. government type of risk, whether it be U.S. Treasuries, U.S. agency debt, or U.S. mortgage-backed securities. So many investors that went into the Barclays Aggregate 5 or 10 years ago thinking they were getting a diversified pool of fixed income assets, that diversification has gone away over time. But we don't think investors can have to sit still, and we think there are some changes that investors can make to position their core bond portfolio on a go-forward basis. And those are shown on page 7. The first one just talks about increasing duration flexibility. The Barclays Aggregate Index has about 5 years of U.S. interest rate risk. By increasing the duration band around that five-year mark, managers can tactically allocate interest rate risk. You could also lower your structural duration by choosing a benchmark that has lower interest rate sensitivity, maybe an intermediate ag that has 4 years of duration versus 5 years. The one giveaway, though, is nothing is a free lunch and you lose yield if you lower your duration within the portfolio. The second theme that I think might be of interest is global expansion, which is actually theme 3 on this page. But instead of just having U.S. fixed income risk, you could expand to other developed markets or potentially even emerging markets just to diversify the interest rate risk around the world. And lastly, and one of the things Mark talked about 2 years ago, was tactical allocations to certain sectors. And we appreciate this board's willingness to allow PIMCO to invest in high-yield securities 2 years ago. It has been a net positive, but we could expand that as a potential way to protect against rising rates in the future of fixed income.
Great. I'll jump in here. Good to see everyone again. And maybe today's newspaper is a little ironic on this particular headline: GM debt sheds junk label. It was about 2 years ago on my last visit here, where we had another educational session that Paul asked for, and we discussed the allowance in your portfolio guidelines to go below investment grade. One of the key examples we gave at that time was Ford Motor Credit. That's maybe why I'm pointing to GM here. Ford, if you recall, during the crisis, did not go under, but it did get a junk rating. And about the time we were in here last, or at least I was in here last, that was a company that we felt very strongly would be raised up to investment grade, that was doing all the right things, and should any demand in autos come, that it would probably be rated investment grade. And sure enough, you're owning an investment grade credit that you bought at junk bond yield level, so that's been a real nice success for you, and there's been some others in the portfolio. I bring that up only as an example of the potential benefits from widening guidelines, and really that's what this educational session is all about. Paul's asked us to come in and talk about this idea of unconstrained. And unconstrained is really that. You're taking some of the mandate that goes along with a normal core or core plus bond mandate and saying to the manager, we can relax some of these standard guidelines that you need to work within. And so I wanted to explain to you what we do in that space and why folks are looking at it. I will say, since we started our mutual fund in the space and we run separate accounts, the mutual fund itself is quite successful and popular. It's about $35 billion in size, not so bad since starting in 08. and we have another $10 billion or so in separate accounts. So a lot of clients are thinking about this. Some of the funding is cannibalistic in that some of it comes from our total return, core plus style, meaning some are new clients, but others take a look at their core plus portfolio, and they say, you know what, these we are worried about some of the things that you were talking about earlier and hear about rates rising and how do you protect a portfolio against it. And so some folks have moved 20%, 30%, maybe even 50% into something like unconstrained. So one other thing I did want to mention on one of Todd's charts, and we don't have to turn back to that, but he did mention that the Treasury position in the aggregate index it now has a 9-year duration. That's a very substantial number, meaning any 100 basis point change in rates drops the 10-year Treasury value by 9%. Big number. What is not evident immediately is that also the other big position in the index being mortgage-backed securities. Think about what happens there. If you all have loans that you've recently refied, and now you're not refying anymore, putting all those people at B of A and Wells Fargo out of a job. I mean, that's the reality of what's happening. Everybody's refied. Rates are up. Nobody's refying. What happens to that security? What happens to that mortgage? You are not going to be prepaying that mortgage. And so that itself extends to become a longer and longer bond. Who would prepay a mortgage at 3.5% unless they were going through a move, a divorce, or some other reason, job change to marry? So that is another hidden part of the duration that's baked into the core or the index of what's going on in the bond world. So moving on into what investors are looking at, if we want to go to tab 2 and take a look at page 9, when you look at the index of the Barclays Ag, it is shown on the top of this page. It's really just those three buckets. If we look at what the global fixed income opportunity is, we've got a very, very different pie chart here that shows the availability of different sectors of the bond market that, candidly, a lot of folks do not take advantage of. In case you're wondering what some of the abbreviations are down below, really the only one that might be confusing is IG. That stands for investment grade rather than high yield. So you can see there's a lot of different ways to get bond exposure. And so if we move one more page, I'd like to show you the differences between a standard portfolio like your portfolio, which is shown here with your exact guidelines, total return, Stancera, paired up against the unconstrained guidelines. And I'm sorry if the print is small, but basically some of the key differences are down in the green greenish-brown down at the bottom. And let's look at these. So the first one is that your committee has decided that we can move positive 35% plus or minus the index. I'm down here at the bottom, so we see Stancera right there. If we look at unconstrained, we actually can move this portfolio in a much wider duration band. We can move it to minus 3 years to positive 8 years. I will tell you that that is a very wide band. It gives us a lot of freedom. And again, we're here as an educational session. This is just our version. There are other versions of unconstrained out there. But in many cases, you'll see wider duration bands as one of the key components. Let me point out, though, a negative 3-year duration. What is that? What is interesting about a negative duration is that we can construct a portfolio, should we do it in the right time, where if rates rise and we have a negative duration, your bond portfolio doesn't get hurt. In fact, it benefits. You have a negative duration. It's somewhat akin to the anti-bond. Rates go up, regular bonds get hurt. Rates go up, you have a negative duration, you actually benefit. So that's something very interesting and very different compared to the conventional space of the bond world. Other items that we can draw attention to are, again, removing additional constraints. High yield, emerging markets, non-U.S. dollar, currency exposures, and derivatives. And so right now you allow no derivatives. We see that very plainly and clearly. Should you want an unconstrained portfolio, really the only way to get a negative duration, unfortunately, is to allow derivatives. So that would be a discussion point here at your committee to understand if that's the right thing for you. I remember having our talk last time about derivatives. They're certainly a four-letter word in many vocabularies, but really what's happened over the years when folks get involved with derivatives in a bad way is because they lever them up. They move with the same volatility as standard securities. There's no difference in that. The trick is not to lever them up. PIMCO's been using them. We're a firm that's close to 45 years old. The first derivatives came around in 1974. We've been using them since then. So they are a productive part of what a portfolio can include. And should you want an unconstrained portfolio, you might want to consider potentially allowing that constraint to widen. So let's move a little bit further. Page 11 is interesting. So what we show here is if we look at the Barclays aggregate, just let's focus on the top colorful charts. The Barclays Ag has, this is all the way on the left, has all of this blue as its risk factor. So this is the estimated volatility it would have in a year, which is about 4%, 400 basis points. Most of it is coming from duration. That is your risk by holding a core portfolio. Let's cut to the chase. Your risk is if rates rise. We show our approach to it, which tries to diversify it a little bit. That's the PIMCO total return approach. And then we show two other, perhaps, considerations. A 50-50 split between total return and unconstrained, and then 100% unconstrained. And you can see that the diversity of the volatility is actually better. And really, that's what we're coming at with you today, is you don't have to pinpoint your bond portfolio into all taking duration risks. There are other risks, and they are risks, but there are other risks that you can take that can protect you against everyone's fear, which is rising rates.
Mark?
Yes.
It says that there's, on that far right, on the 100% unconstrained, there's 317 basis points of estimated contribution of volatility.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot for other factors. What is other factors?
Right. So what it comes down to is when you go with an unconstrained approach, you've effectively taken out the core or the base of what a bond portfolio manager is dealing with, a PIMCO or your other managers, which I understand are Dodge and Cox. When you set that home base, that's what you look like on the left. When you start removing those constraints, idiosyncratic risk, to use a large word, is basically how's that manager done? What is their alpha potential? How are they using the different tools? And so, again, a risk, we're trying to be educational here, the pros and cons. One of the things to consider is if you do unconstrained, you better have a lot of faith in that manager,
exactly,
because you've taken away, I know you guys are familiar with the term beta, you've taken away the bond beta from that manager, and you said, you guys know best, you guys go ahead. And so the goal on this is interesting, right? We in the total return approach, we're shooting for somewhere around the Barclays Ag plus 100. The goal on an unconstrained is LIBOR plus 300. So it's floating. We heard about these floating rates in the prior speaker. In other words, you know, what you want to, if you want to start protecting yourself against rising rates, you want to start moving into potentially some things that are floating. And although we're not investing in, you know, exactly floating rate securities, the portfolio is run in a fashion where that duration can float and move in a very wide band. So you're right, it's other, and it can come from very many sources, just not duration.
I have a little problem with that description, because basically what you're saying to me, mm-hmm, is unconstrained is uncontrolled. We don't know what our risks are, and we'd have a heck of a time explaining to other people why we allowed a manager risk if we lost control and didn't know what happened.
Right. Good point. I think if we can go back to that page, we don't have to, but think of the page I showed you. There are constraints in there. They're quite wide, but specifically when we had something called the unconstrained bond strategy and we have constraints, what's that all about? What we did not want is this to turn into a product that could have equities. that could have real estate, that could have commodities, that could have categories that don't act like bonds. What we have done is we've said, let's remove the general constraints or at least make them wider. That's why you see those bigger bands. So I wouldn't say uncontrolled, at least in my opinion, because there are controls in there. They just happen to be much wider in the spectrum that you're giving the money manager.
How would we explain to our constituents what controls we've placed if something adverse happened?
Yeah, the volatility target of an unconstrained mandate tends to be consistent with a core plus bond mandate. So a core plus bond mandate or a Barclays Ag mandate tends to have volatility of, call it, 3-6%. And that's how we manage our unconstrained approach as well. We look at all the positions within the portfolio, size what's the expected volatility of those positions, and ensure that it's consistent with what a core bond portfolio would deliver. Because at the end of the day, a core bond portfolio, whether it be in the Barclays Ag or unconstrained, still has to deliver some key characteristics. Has to provide liquidity, has to provide income, equity diversification, and should provide income for pension plans and other asset pools that use unconstrained approach.
You don't sound convinced. We'll keep going, and perhaps we can get you over to the other side. But let's take a look at 13 for a second. 13 is a chart that shows, believe it or not, since the inception of our approach to unconstrained, there's been quite a few rising rate periods. The red dots are periods where the 10-year treasury yield went up. So again, these are times when we can be pretty sure your bond portfolio suffered. And so if you look at the gold bars, you see most of them being under zero during rate rises. So that's the Barclays Ag. You are getting negative returns in those environments. The blue is what happened with the unconstrained approach. And granted, the one on the right, which is the current one, we've still not above zero in the unconstrained, but it's a lot less painful than what's happened in any bond portfolio that's out there right now. But what I think is most interesting is look all the way at the left. In the period we've been running this, which is about 60 months, believe it or not, there's been 30 months where rates have gone up. So half the months, we hear all about the fact that rates have fallen. Half the months since 2008 have seen rises in treasury yields. And here what we show in the blue is in those rising rate environments, this approach is up 4%. And the standard approach is almost down 4%. So it just gives you a little bit of background on how rising rates don't necessarily have to be painful.
So the most recent period, one could take that you were surprised by that, where prior periods in rising rates you somewhat expected that.
I think that's a good comment. I would say that the we've been feeling that rates eventually have to go up, but they went up a lot more dramatically in the second quarter than we thought. And it's reflected there. Again, we didn't fall as much as conventional bonds, but we would have liked that to be above zero.
But also be clear on the prior point slide. As you stated, you have wide bands mm-hmm. that allow you to operate to create alpha above cash. But when you're making investments, you internally know the risk you're taking within those bands and quantify that and explain to clients what risk you're taking.
Right. If we didn't have that one down,
we'd be out of business. Right.
So let me take you to... Yes. Oh, sorry.
On page 13. Yes. I'm sorry. Sure. I'm curious how your total return reacted in those same environments.
Total return fund for you has been net positive. Todd was sharing the numbers with me earlier. Mm-hmm. So I would put them somewhere in between the ag and the unconstrained. Remember, these are only rising rate environments.
Right.
So we haven't been hurt as much as the aggregate, but certainly an unconstrained approach would have assisted in the overall picture. Again,
it'd be interesting to see, you know, just how much
how much it meant.
Better it would have done in the unconstrained than it would have done than it did with a total return or with our parameters. You know, was it a great deal more or was it just a little more?
That's something we'd be happy to follow up with you on. And I think, again, the idea is a blend of this is what we see many clients doing, because to go all the way into unconstrained, at least in my opinion, is a bit overkill, although we see some doing it. But some move into that would help you in periods like this. Let's move to 15 for a second. This is a chart or a table on correlations. So this is back to perhaps Mr. Ford's question. Maybe we can gain a little yardage here. I'm not sure, but I'll try. One of the things that we, again, did not want to do is have a wide open, say, Wild West approach where it's just anything. You might as well call it a hedge fund if that's your game. What we did when we created the idea here is to say, as Todd was referring to, we want the volatility to be somewhat near conventional bonds. And if that were the case, we would want also the correlation to be somewhat geared to what's going on in the bond market. So here in the very first column, I show the PIMCO unconstrained bond versus different asset classes. You see it's very small correlation to equities, only 0.18. And again, the correlation is, if it's positive 1, that's perfectly correlated. If it's negative 1, that's perfectly negatively correlated. So this has had positive correlation, but very small to the equity markets, 8.18, 0.09. Very small to commodities. But take a look down below, U.S. bonds, 0.5. So it's been pretty heavily correlated to U.S. bonds. How does that compare to the ag? Well, obviously the ag is 100% correlated to itself. How does that compare to the PIMCO total return? 0.78. So that has a lot higher correlation to bonds. But we haven't lost all correlation to bonds, which is what we want to accomplish in this unconstrained approach. And the last column there shows the volatility of these different categories. 369 is the volatility of the bond market, and ours has been, what, 3.7? 3.7? Yeah, so that's shown on the prior page. So I'm not sure if we picked anything there for you, Mr. Ford, but what we're trying to say is we understand that this is a leap, but it's a leap that is preparing one for, very realistically, an environment where the last 30 years of falling bond yields, which got everybody around this table better returns, is probably not going to happen. So we can sit here and stay with core bonds, no argument there, or you can try to anticipate and react, and that's what we see some clients doing. Let me show you a couple more charts, and then we can finish up with some questions and concluding remarks. I wanted to show you a little bit about what the portfolio looks like if we look at maybe page 22. Because I don't want to walk out of here without a clear understanding of what types of spectrum of allowance you're giving a manager. On top of page 22, we show that the current portfolio's duration is 1.8 years. This is interest rate exposure. But look at what it's made up of. Positive duration from the United States of 2.8 years, positive from Australia and Brazil, and actually negative duration out of Europe and Japan. Why? Well, we think rates in Japan are going to go up. You guys have probably heard about Abenomics. I know you have quite a few presentations going around here. The whole thing with Abe is he's looking to raise interest rates in Japan, and we believe he will be successful for the next couple of years. So we don't want to hone Japan duration because rates are going to go up and your bond prices are going to fall. Same thing with Europe. In the European rates, right now they're very much held down by the ECB and something called the LTRO and all of the machinations behind the European banking crisis trying to hold those rates down. We think that investors will finally, call their bluff and force them to pay higher interest rates. So we don't want duration coming out of Europe. In fact, we want to benefit if rates rise in Europe. Therefore, we have a negative duration. We can go through the rest of these if you like, but these are examples. Well, let's go through agency mortgages. In this particular case, this was as of June 30th, we had 1.1 years in positive duration coming from lower coupon mortgages and negative one coming from higher coupon mortgages. And that is something that fell right into our hands as far as good performance. Why? Well, when the Fed signaled tapering, some of the mortgages got hit pretty hard, and they happened to be the higher coupon mortgages. And so that was a good trade for unconstrained. The page continues, or the ideas continue to 23, but I just wanted to share with you that there's a lot going on underneath the hood in this portfolio, but there are controls and constraints. And so even though it is named unconstrained, there are ideas required of us to make it have a lot of consistency with a core bond portfolio. Yes?
So basically, your long assets where you believe you can get yield, and your short assets where you believe yield is going to rise, or rates are going to rise.
Well put.
That's the strategy.
That's one component of it. Then there's also the ability to tactically add certain other strategy or other exposures, et cetera. But that's
but
a relative
value. Going up in Japan because they've told us they're going to go up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it makes sense not to bet on Japan in an interest rate risk environment. You short that asset, so when the value of those, or when those rates do rise, we can sell that at a higher value, get our money back. But we're long in assets that we believe are going to perform well in an interest rate environment on the short to intermediate term.
Exactly.
That's right.
What I'd expand on your point on, because it's completely accurate, but it just doesn't stop at interest rates. I mean, we skipped the second one. Let's just cover it. Corporates.
There's got to be an economic component to it in the corporate environment.
Yeah. So in corporates, what we've done is we actually have, this is interesting, we have a net negative in overall corporate exposure. What this means is if corporate bond spreads widen, you'll benefit. Okay, that basically tells you that our view is corporate bond spreads are too tight in mass. However, there's pockets where we're long corporate exposure, investment-grade financials, select high-yield bonds, Ford would be one. And there's areas where we're short corporate bonds, investment-grade in the other bucket, and some of the high-yield names that we don't like. So, again, you could take the same representation that you correctly gave, and you gave it in interest rate space. We're trying to do it in corporate bond space, mortgage space, currency space, inflation link space, and all
this
the way down the line.
You can add to a bond portfolio additional yield. It's because in the AGG index, you have to own bonds.
It's a long only.
Long only, no protection.
No protection. And it's
the way you're adding yield here or spice to the portfolio is that short position.
That's right.
How long have you been running a short portfolio? Six years? Or?
Well, this particular portfolio has 5 years of performance history. We have been taking the short side of things for a long time. I realize that this particular fund does not allow derivatives, but ever since derivatives have been around, we've been able to tailor the duration in many ways. One of the trades that really made clients a lot of money was right during the crisis when Fannie and Freddie were looking like they were going to be absorbed by the government. Nobody wanted to own agency-backed mortgage bonds. We went extremely long those in accounts that allowed derivatives, but that was too much duration for the overall portfolio. So we went long mortgage exposure and sold the duration by shorting Treasury futures. That brought the duration down to a reasonable level, but allowed the portfolios to benefit from that misalignment. And misalignments happen all the time.
On average, Mark, or a guesstimate, what percent of this unconstrained is made up of physicals and what percent made up of derivatives?
I would say the lion's share is physicals.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. The derivatives are needed around the edges to shorten position. But if you want a short Japanese position, 100% of that Japanese position is going to need to be short, because you can't go out and buy a Japanese bond that gives you negative duration. You have to do something to get the negative.
Will ever adding the long and short positions get you above 100% in this?
No, it's designed as an unlevered strategy. I think that's maybe back to my original comment about derivatives.
Right.
Derivatives get people in trouble when they're levered.
Right.
This is designed to be unlevered.
So you're 60 long, 30 short, 10 cash,
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Yeah.
Cool. We back all derivatives with cash, essentially, cash equivalents.
Do you find that you ever have trouble explaining the use of derivatives to some of your potential clients? And if so, how do you allay any fears that might be out there?
That has been a problem since Orange County. So, and I've been in the markets for about 30 years. So, yeah, do I find I ever have any problems? Yeah, no question. It scares people. Folks that are not in the markets every day or don't have a long background in derivatives, they stay away from things they don't know. The reality is that derivatives have a place that it should be right next door to cash securities, because they react very similarly. A interest rate swap, which is a derivative, acts just like a treasury bond. A credit default swap acts just like a corporate bond. These things are very similar. However, the real problem is to get exposure on the cash side, you have to put down, you hang up the phone with the broker, you buy $1 million worth of bonds, you owe them $1 million at T+3. If you buy that same exposure in a derivative, it could be 3 months before you own that. And so it's the greedy folks, it's the unwashed that might go after more and more yield and more aggressive techniques. Paul knows our derivatives practice. We have committees, risk committees, counterparty risk committees. I mean, we use a lot of derivatives in most cases. This is something we do not take very lightly. And so that control mechanism, in our view, is absolutely mandatory to be allowed to do something like this. And it's something we've been working on since the 70s, because we have been an active participant since then. But yeah, it's never easy.
And there's been a movement to move more derivative to exchanges as well. So you're seeing the regulatory framework. Some of the things PIMCO has been doing for years, like settling on a daily basis, some of this is now becoming mandatory as part of the new Dodd-Frank regulations. So we think overall that it's moving in the market's moving in a great direction, and we're very supportive. But we've been doing many of the policies and procedures for years.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So exchange traded is different than, that's a whole different mantra. And again, you have to have the wherewithal. Like a PIMCO, I mean, we're a large money manager. We manage almost $2 trillion. We have added so many compliance people to deal with the fact that the regulators want these traded on exchange as opposed to over the counter. So that's becoming more and more the case. Let me ask for any more questions, and if there are none, I have kind of a wrap-up statement, but let me just make sure we hit everybody's questions.
I don't think this is the proper investment for a retirement fund. Derivatives, junk bonds in particular, hedge funds and commodities are not something this board should invest in. Blue Ready, against my objection, invested in a hedge fund, lost $10 million in 1 year in derivatives and junk bonds like you guys are pushing. It's not the right place for it.
The problem is politics. The problem is the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
If you make money, nobody's going to worry. If you lose it, it's going to be derivative risk, unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you're saying. The name, the title, it's unfair. If I hurt somebody with a pencil, then pencils are dangerous.
Right.
It's difficult. I imagine that in especially California, you're having more problem with pension funds accepting the kind of stuff.
You know, actually, the California counties, and I'm sure you have friends at many of these places, these are clients in unconstrained strategies. So I don't cite that as, trying to push you into it, but I would say some boards have been able to adopt this plan, and I think it's the ones that are the most worried about this environment over the last 30 years that has helped all of us with rates falling and created really unrealistic return assumptions from bonds that today are yielding 2 and change, and you know, is not going to hit your return assumptions in a very helpful way. And it's a struggle. This is not an easy decision. Certainly there are folks that feel one way and folks that feel the other way. But the reason for Paul inviting us was to certainly allow you to look at something that others are doing. I mean, think about it, $45 billion in our assets are in these unconstrained accounts, and there's public plans all over the United States that are doing it.
Paul, if you were to recommend the strategy to the board, what are we talking about in terms of the allocation of the fixed income portfolio to this strategy?
Well, I would, this is a discussion, but off the top of my head, I would say I would entertain the thought of just taking PIMCO's existing portfolio and making it 50% the way it is, 50% unconstrained as presented.
So PIMCO is about 20% of the fixed income portfolio, so we're looking at about 10% of the fixed income portfolio.
Yes. PIMCO is about one, yes, exactly right.
Which represents 3%, 2.5% to 3% of the total.
Right, but it's more addressing the concerns of some of the board members on the use of derivatives, which, we can have that discussion next time.
In terms of the total return that the fixed income portfolio may throw off over the next 1 to 2 to 3 years, what kind of marginal increase in yield do you see us getting over the entire fixed income portfolio? Are we picking up 20 basis points, 10 basis points?
On a flat interest rate environment, I'd put the two somewhat equal, and so no pickup.
Okay.
And I think that's an important part. We're not here to say this is the greatest thing since sliced bread because it pays you while you wait.
Really talking about duration management, which
it's a preparation for the fact that if you do not move in a way like this and rates increase, your fixed income portfolio is going to lose money whether we're trying to manage it or not. You've got too much duration risk in that component of it.
Yeah, we've lived it for the last year.
Yeah.
For the aggregate.
Yeah.
What's the worst performing interest rate environment, or what's the worst interest rate environment going forward in terms of your performance? Flat, lower, or higher?
For the unconstrained?
Yeah.
May, June.
No, he asked going forward. Here's what I'd say, and this is going to be hard to swallow, maybe for Mr. Gordon, but the idea is you've given us the flexibility where we could be absolutely negative 3 years in duration, right when the next crushing quarter like this quarter came, and we could be up 9% if rates rise like that. And so this is designed to be a approach that can stomach any interest rate environment, right? Because this is not a strategy just to shorten up your duration. If it were, we would recommend, if that was your only goal, just go into something simpler without derivatives and go into the short-term bond strategy.
Okay.
You're taking duration off the table in a strategic way.
This is management.
This is a tactical, alpha-oriented fund.
But the worst environment is a May-June period where real rates rise quickly, sharply in a small time period, and the active managers are not prepared for that.
Yeah. I should rephrase the question.
Okay.
What would be the most difficult environment for you to manage going forward? Rising, lowering, or flat?
An environment where the Fed changes their stance pretty drastically against our So when we saw on May 22nd when they totally changed their stance, and we saw it last week where they kind of reversed course and went back to what PIMCO's stance was on interest rates as we looked forward.
Which can very well happen again.
It can very well happen going forward, but the Fed doesn't want to create too much volatility in the marketplace. They're trying to dampen volatility to stimulate economic growth. So I think in a lot of ways they've learned their lesson.
Speaking of the Fed real quick, so this is a defensive play. It's not an offensive play, this unconstrained portfolio. That's really the pitch. It's not to make additional return. It's to keep equities protected. That's really what you're talking about. But we're going to have a new Fed chair in January. What's your opinion of what their monetary policy is going to be as it relates to rates?
Yeah, Janet Yellen, you know, is
one of, to be the front runner.
Would be the front runner. We could maybe in the next couple weeks see an official nomination. We haven't seen any speeches out of her recently, as they're probably doing their vetting at the White House and others in Washington. So she's probably the front runner for the Fed. And she's been one of the architects behind some of the policy we're seeing in the marketplace. So when you think about quantitative easing and the $85 billion worth of purchases by the Federal Reserve on a monthly basis, she was one of the big architects of that program. So we would expect Janet Yellen to remain very accommodative and very dovish for the foreseeable future, and to keep the policy rate, which is the Fed funds rate, low until economic growth picks up. Currently, unemployment is about 7.3% in the U.S. The Fed has signaled that they wouldn't raise the policy rate until unemployment hit 6.5%. And then last week they said, and possibly beyond the 6.5% mark. And then also inflation, their target is 2 to 2.5%. Currently, their favorite measure of inflation, the PCE, personal consumption expenditures, is at 1.4%, so well below their inflation target. So we would imagine, long answer, but Yellen to be very accommodative and continue the Ben Bernanke type of path.
Super dove.
Super dovish.
As feedback, I would suggest the title is my biggest problem. If the newspaper said, lost money from unconstrained portfolio, it just doesn't work.
Got it. You know, it's a popular name for a fund, but as a separate account, you could call it whatever
Marfa.
You want.
I don't care anything.
But I do have an interesting question to leave at the table here, and that is, I certainly hear your concerns about all the things you mentioned, hedge funds, junk bonds, derivatives, et cetera. The question that is hard for a person in your position and everyone at this table is, if that's the case and you want to stand on conventional bonds, are you willing to lower your assumed rate of return? And I think that's the thing that people struggle with.
Well, and we did lower it last year. I suppose we'll lower it again. Yeah, this is a retirement fund. Mm-hmm. It's not some speculative thing for 20-year-olds who want to just roll the dice and see how much money they can make. It's irresponsible to invest in things like junk bonds and derivatives. You know, what the goal of this retirement board, at least it used to be, was to try to get up as close to 100% of our funding as we can, and then start shifting our money into safer investments so we don't have this volatility that we had and where we lost $400 million in, I don't know, about 2009, 8 or 9, something like that. So that was what I thought we were going to do, was to, you know, do our regular investments, try and get that fund up, and then go into safer investments. Instead, what we did was we threw away $10 million in this hedge fund, something we should have never invested in. And yours is just about as bad. And I mean, this is, you know, I'm really opposed to it. And I can say this is a retirement fund here, and it's you're out of place pushing the junk bonds and derivatives here.
Whatever happened to someone's junk is another one's treasure.
Yeah, they are junk bonds. That's what they are. They call them high yield, but they are junk. And we shouldn't be investing in it. And we changed our policy just so we could invest in these types of things. This is something we should never do. One of the things I've complained about is it's so easy for us to just change our investment policy to jump into something that we should have no business in.
Or said the reverse way, if our portfolio assumption rate is too high, and we are forced to take unreasonable risks. Mm-hmm. Is it prudent to take the risk rather than face reality?
That is a question that the taxpayers will have to deal with if you lower that assumed rate. And see, that we all come, again, to meetings like this where that is the real crux of the issue. Are you going to lower that assumed rate of return? Because granted, I hear these complaints, but the issue is, straight bonds are going to get you 2.5%. So, and they're going to really hurt you in a rising rate environment. And so the idea is to at least show you something that doesn't have that characteristic. And otherwise, we're kidding ourselves if you're going to get what you did the last 30 years out of bond returns, which was 7, 8, 9% out of bonds.
My answer to your question, I think, is we represent a group of people. The group of people we represent, when you take their money and they invest it in deferred comp, 50% or more of them put it in extremely safe stuff. Mm-hmm. So we are going to take risks on their behalf that they don't normally take in the world.
Right. Except that when people put, I hear what you're saying, but except that in deferred comp, I mean, they've got a guaranteed 4%, number one, if they put it into the safest option. But they also invest in an organization that assumes that they know better. Again, if some of the studies that we've seen, if given a choice of multiple stocks or whatever, people tend to make bad decisions. If they did it on, like, for example, when we were considering defined contributions as opposed to defined benefits. So anyways, and what I'm also hearing is, I hear, Jim, what you're saying, definitely we are taking care of the taxpayer and employees' contributions, but I'm also hearing that we're also concerned about publicity.
Publicity only from the standpoint of the fact that the people we represent, how would
what
they
people?
Feel?
Define the people.
The money that we're raising, our employees and our retirees.
Okay.
I would say one of the things we have to look at realistically is since 2008, 2009, we've had a huge paradigm shift in the financial markets and in the investment arena. And I think just as much as we have to look at publicity risk as to what we invest in, I think we have to look at, if, you know, like Jason said, you know, if we're looking at 5 years out and we look at our peer group, our peer group is far exceeding us because we're in this very conservative, ultra-conservative investment classes, and everybody is outpacing us. So you're right, Jim, we can be very safe, and we can show everybody that we have very little to zero risk on the table, but everybody else is outpacing us, and so we keep sending a higher and higher bill to the taxpayer, because our investment returns keep getting lower and lower. So we have to balance the approach. We really do. And that's the part of bringing people here and doing this education. It's not that we're going to invest in it, but I think it's to show that here's an alternative out there. So I agree, we don't want to find ourselves where we're chasing alpha, and that's our main focus. But we also want to realize that there's been a huge paradigm shift in the world of investments. So that's all I'd like to add.
And the other thing, too, is I think I heard you early on in the discussion is this is really more of a balanced risk. I mean, they not the flat-out derivative issues. And I'm going to say I'm the least, I understand derivatives the least of all, probably. So, but what I'm hearing is that it's a controlled risk. Nothing is without risk. We see that with bonds, flat out. And I've always been, of course, a proponent of education. And I mean the public, ourselves, et cetera, so that they understand, if there is a blow, they understand where we were coming from. So it's a balanced response on our part, too.
I think this discussion is a very good discussion to have, because I think it gives us a chance to vet our views on the proper amount of risk and reward to take, and I think that we're always going to have these types of discussions. We're never going to solve this problem and figure out exactly how much we should be investing in bonds and how much we should be investing in equities. But over time, we're going to strive to get it right, and hopefully we take the proper amount of risk given the economic environment that confronts us at the time, and we're just going to continue to go through this process over and over. I mean, who knows? Maybe interest rates may jump 500 basis points on the far end of the Treasury curve. And guess what, folks? A lot of our problem is solved, because then we will be able to achieve our assumed discount rate now investing in something that offers very little risk. So
I think what we're doing here is good. I think it's great to hear everybody's opinion here, and it keeps us on our toes and prepares us for the next.
I think it's a question that has to be asked on what to do with core plus fixed mm-hmm. income. And when one outcome is a rising rate environment, and there's no easy answer to mm-hmm. it, and I think moving away from core to other strategies involve takes more risk to get a higher type of return. That's what capital markets are. But we have to have that discussion, and we all have different viewpoints, but I think we have to keep talking about this, because having 30% of core plus fixed income is a dangerous place to be if the outcome is rising rates, and we to thank PIMCO and treat them with respect for coming here and giving us an education session and potential solution. We may not agree with it, mm-hmm. but it does create discussion, as Rick said, and that's healthy. And, you know, there are other outcomes. I mean, if we decide to stay in core and core plus only, maybe we should lower our fixed income allocation further. Maybe it's a off-the-cuff reaction, but, you know, we'll continue the discussion next time on what we learned today and kind of direction going forward. And it could be stop here on this, continue considering this, and here's something else to consider.
Do you still want to give your closing statement?
No, I think all this is, this is not easy. If it were easy, we would have been done in 5 minutes.
Right.
So I value everyone's input and views, and we are happy to be here in an educational fashion. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to item 10, told by our general counsel that we have no closed session items.
Yay.
So moving on to item 11, members forum. Gordon.
Thank you very much. What's the titles? Nothing. Thank you.
Great to see you again.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Gordon, you have anything?
Nothing.
Fred? Nothing. Jason?
I don't know what I would have.
Well, I did.
I got lots of information.
I did forget one thing. I know not all of us are here, but we did leave out introductions. I know Jim DeMartini left. Michael O'Neill left. But
Jim's still here.
Jeff left, and Jim Stiller. Sorry, Jim. And Michael O'Neill left. Michael, at the end, is our elected retiree rep. I'm a lieutenant with the Sheriff's Department assigned to the cities of Houston and Waterford, and I've been on the board about 10 and a half years. That will be coming to an end at the end of December. So, Gordon is our...
I'm elected treasurer, and I'm going to be here longer than you.
Okay.
Oh, I know who Gordon is.
You probably just got something in the mail, right? There you go.
Yeah, he's sending a nasty letter.
God, it wasn't so nasty. Just you own too much.
You know, you talk about putting stuff on paper and titles. When you send that stuff out, you should leave out the part that if you don't pay the bill, we're going to seize your property. You need to be a little more warm and fuzzy.
A little more positive?
A little more positive,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
When you pay the bill, we won't have to seize your property.
We'll acquire your property.
Yeah.
That's a gentler word.
Fred Silva is our general counsel with the firm of Damrell, Nelson, and Shrimp. And I don't know if you want to give a little background on yourself.
So I'm Jason Gordo. Happy to be here. And I own an investment management company in town called Valley Wealth. We're independent investment advisors. So for the investment advisors in the room, we're RIA. And
yes.
We manage about $325 million of local assets. And we work with a number of pension and profit sharing funds, 401k participants, and high net worth individuals.
I didn't have anything further to say.
Okay, we know Jim. Jim's our board of supervisors.
If I had something to say, I'd say.
I'm not convinced of that, Jim.
And behind you is Doris Foster. She is with the Chief Executive Office, assigned to, be our partner between us and the county. Donna.
If I could just ask a quick question. Rick, a couple months ago, you and I sat down and talked about maybe some risk parameters and reconciliations and so on. Any progress on that?
I've
Absolutely. That's kind of exactly what I'm working on right now. And I'm doing that in conjunction with developing the investment policy statement and the strategic plan. So that's going to be a part of that. And I think what you'll see is in the next month, a very high-level overview of how we're going to attack that problem. And then in January or February, I think we'll get down to the nuts and bolts of the specific tasks on how we're going to accomplish those goals as well.
The investment policy, that'll go to the Internal Governance Committee?
No.
Just the bylaws?
I think what you're talking about in terms of risk parameters, monitoring risk, monitoring, assessing the disposition of our active managers, that's going to be a part of the investment policy statement. But it's also going to be, I'm incorporating that with the strategic action plan, which I thought that those issues were very much on the mind of the boards when we met in November. So they will be at the forefront of the strategic action plan, which we'll present the first draft to you on the 9th of October.
Yay! Thank you.
It's a very challenging exercise to go through, and it really forces you to think about what acknowledging what risk is and how it can affect the portfolio going forward.
And in addition to the individual investments or components, are you going to also address the portfolio as a whole?
Yes.
And how the pieces are working together?
Absolutely. That's a big part of
Thank you.
Analyzing the risk. In fact, Nate just sent me a nice little handy-dandy spreadsheet that I haven't had a chance to look at that allows us to determine the contribution to the overall portfolio risk by manager.
Oh, excellent.
So we can look at the contribution that the manager contributes to risk of the portfolio alongside the return, so we can weigh the contribution to risk and return.
So are you thinking a variety of risk parameters, like the variance and the Sharpe ratio and all of those, or are you just looking at just like...
I got to tell you, there's hundreds of things going through my mind, and I have got to come up with a very, very small subset of what's going through my mind.
Maybe two or three, though, instead of just like one?
Well, my problem is that while I like all these risk parameters and the way I'm looking at risk, if I throw out a lot of stuff to you, then I got to explain it to you.
Yeah, but if you pick just one, it can really skew depending on how the market's moving. And if you pick, say, two or three, you get a much broader view, and it can pick up changes that you're not going to see otherwise. I just think that it would be nice to have.
What I said, Rick has both correlation and variance matrix.
So
along with standard deviation and expected return.
My goal, though, is to take this information and present it in such a way that you can look at it and within 15, 20 seconds understand what it is we're showing you and not have to think about it and be able to ask intelligent questions about it. That's really my goal there.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll cut it off there since it's not an agendized item. So.
It was just a question.
The questions can lead into discussions that then should be agendized,
we
right?
We can agendize Donna's
right.
ideas.
Right.
It was just a question. Where are we? That's all.
Okay. So, Donna Riley, you are?
I am elected to represent the active members.
And you're with?
I am with the General Services Agency. I'm Deputy Director for General Services Agency. And before that, I used to work for Gordon as the Assistant Treasurer.
We're sorry.
And I manage the county's fixed income portfolio.
Maria DeAnda.
I am the kind of the old lady of the group. I've been on the board for, 16 years, give or take? I'm also the elected general member. I am a manager with the Community Services Agency, aka the Welfare Department. I've been around a while. Like now I'm the historian, I guess.
Yes, you are.
Which I occasionally remind people of. So welcome.
Thank you.
Paul, you heard speak. Nate is his partner back there. They're with Strategic Investment Solutions, our advisors, and they're based out of San Francisco. So you will see them the second meeting of every month. The last meeting of the month is our investment meeting, which is what we had today. So, Kathy?
We had the pleasure of
Okay,
Jason,
super.
He came into the office, which was really nice.
All right, so you know everybody's staff.
I spent 3 hours with this guy.
10-4.
Day,
so. All right.
The bill's online.
So anybody have anything else to add? Staff, anybody going once, going twice, seeing none? Meeting is adjourned.